Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
After the big war, there will come a time to rebuild and a need for a new and special kind of soldier.
This man is carrying a loaded weapon.
Prepare to meet the next great American hero.
That's where you come in.
Are you serious?
His name is...
Hell. Sam Hell.
Never heard of you.
We're going to Frogtown.
And this is the adventure he's been waiting for.
We're gonna get him out, and then you're gonna get him pregnant.
And if anyone's got a chance in hell of rescuing the virgins from the evil clutches of Toady...
It's a miracle.
Right.
Be there for the action. The adventure.
Oh, Sam.
What are you doing?
And be there for the dance of the three snakes.
Dance or die.
We're all gonna die.
When hell comes to Frogtown. Starring Rowdy Roddy Piper as Sam.
Get off!
You are one weird dude.
Sandal Bergman as Nurse Spangle.
Wired to blow.
Hell comes to Frogtown.
Eat lamp, froggies!
Minutes after the hour of one, and this the month of February in the year of our Lord 2011. Thank you for coming by, making a part of your day, live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network. This, my friends, is the Rick Emerson radio program, an excursion into whimsy the likes of which you have never before experienced and which you may not survive. It is Friday, February the 11th, 2011, and welcome to day 12. Hello, Don Taylor.
Hi.
What do you mean you haven't seen Hell Comes to Frogtown?
I have never seen Hell Comes to Frogtown.
Hello, Don Taylor.
Hi.
What do you mean you haven't seen Hell Comes to Frogtown?
I just somehow have never seen Hell Comes to Frogtown. It just hasn't happened.
When you say it just hasn't happened, that's... That's like something that a woman tells a marriage counselor about why she's unable to achieve physical fulfillment. This is Hell Comes to Frogtown, woman.
I have never sought it out, and it has never just sort of fallen into my lap. So therefore, it has not happened.
Rowdy Roddy Piper, the last fertile man on Earth, responsible for rescuing Earth women from the clutches of evil frogs who stand 6 feet tall and carry scepters and laser guns, so that he can impregnate the Earth women and repopulate the species, so they can then overthrow their frog masters. Come on!
Well, that sounds like a fine, fine piece of cinema.
Here's the thing. Amazingly, it's not.
No.
It's actually pretty bad, but sort of...
No.
But see, but there's that whole, you know, well, it's so bad, it's good. I mean, maybe this falls into that category, I guess, technically, except that it's like, I don't think they're under any illusion that it's going to be a good movie to begin with. I think they just decided, like, hey, why not? Somebody had some money, somebody got drunk, somebody signed a contract, bam, you're making Hell Comes to Frogtown. And, I mean, there you go. And plus, it's got... Here's the weird thing about Hell Comes to Frogtown. And this, by the way, is apart from all the stuff I just said about radioactive frogs and got to impregnate Earth ladies. By the way, also, Rowdy Roddy Piper wears this sort of, this huge metal electric codpiece to protect his unit.
Well, of course, he's the only fertile man left. He's got to protect that.
He's got a loaded weapon, Don, and it's got to be kept protected at all times.
So is everything all radioactive and everything? Is that why he has a metal
thing? Yes, it is. In fact, it...
I'm sorry,
Do you need a thing over there?
I don't want to offend you with, like, goop in my teeth, so I'm making sure that...
The word is gunk, I think, okay, is what you're looking for there. So you're just, do you need a toothpick?
I should have probably brushed my teeth while I had the chance, but...
Do you need a toothbrush?
No, I have a toothbrush.
Okay.
I just failed to brush my teeth while I had the chance.
Okay, I'm just...
Between shows. I was busy doing the paperwork and the housekeeping and such.
I'm not finding fault. I didn't even find fault with the fact that you crap in your teeth. Doesn't matter to me.
Thank you.
Rick Emerson's not picky. Here's the thing about Hell Comes to Frogtown, just real quickly. And those of you who've seen this fine piece of cinema, you know what I'm talking about. And by the way, can I just say this? Amazingly, and I don't think he was just saying this to be... I don't think he was just saying this like in a you're the best audience ever kind of a way. You know, it's like where somebody comes, you know, like you see Meatloaf and he goes, you guys are the... We were in Seattle last night and you guys are way better than those, you know... And everybody goes, we're better than another town. I don't think he meant it in this way, but when we had Rowdy Piper in the studio one time and I was like, dude, we have to talk about Hell Comes to Frogtown. And he actually, and he flushed. He got kind of embarrassed, and he said, Hell Comes to Frogtown. I don't know why I made that movie. You're the first person in, like, you know, 5 years that's mentioned it, too. And I was actually sort of impressed with myself that I had mentioned Hell Comes to Frogtown when nobody else apparently did.
Everybody wants to talk about They Live.
They Live.
They Live has had the sort of renaissance.
That's a great film.
In the last 5 years or so, where it's been rediscovered,
There's
I think.
There's been no renaissance for They Live and Rick Emerson. That movie never went away.
No, it never did.
That's a fine film. But Hell Comes to Frogtown has one of the best opening moments of any film I've ever seen, and I'm not making that up, and I'm not being ironic when I say that. Because it takes place after a nuclear war, and all the men are either dead or sterile, or sort of, you know, they've just become useless in terms of in reproductive terms. And so Rowdy Piper, though, for reasons that I can't really remember, I think it's because he was a prisoner, and so he was, like, maybe being kept underground, like, in a lead-lined vault or something, because he was a badass, sort of Simon Phoenix-like, and so his junk was protected. But it's got this great opening moment, where there's just a black screen, and this woman in a sort of icy British delivery says... In the late 20th century, there arose a difference of opinion. And then they just cut to a full screenshot of a mushroom cloud, which is awesome. It's a great opening for a movie. And then the rest of the movie kind of sucks.
Oh.
Except for the fact that, again, giant frogs stand 6 feet tall, scepters, laser guns. And then at some point, later on in the film, there are frogs trying to seduce the Earth ladies. And then the Earth ladies respond by hypnotizing the frogs by doing something called the Dance of the Three Veils, which involves sweating a lot and wearing gauzy undergarments. And so when you're like 14, it's already like the best movie you've ever seen or could hope to see.
But you don't actually see the ladies with the 6-foot-tall frog guts.
No, that would be unnatural, Don.
Oh. See, that would be the thing that I would find sexy.
Well, okay then. Let's go back to talking about gunk in your teeth.
Okay.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's Friday. Thank you for coming by. If you'd like to be for joining us today, that's 503-505-6964. Perhaps with your own Hell Comes to Frogtown reminiscences. It's 503-505-6964. I bet you,
Where were you when you first saw Hell Comes to Frogtown?
I bet that... Actually, I don't know that Jim Willig has seen it or not. I'll bet you David Walker's seen it more than once.
Oh, yeah.
I bet he's seen it like 3 times.
Probably worked on it.
Probably.
Probably, like, dated one of the ladies that was hypnotizing the toads.
I got to tell you that, you know what I did last night? Is I read a little bit of David Walker's, I read some of his novel. I've been reading his serialized Darius Logan and the Super Justice Force.
Yeah.
I've been reading it online. And, I mean, and when I say, like, it sounds like... It almost sounds like if I say, well, and it's good, but like I expected it not to be. And it's not that, of course, I didn't expect it to be good because he's a great writer. I just didn't know what to expect, period, in terms of the tone or the content, because it's a young... I mean, he says it's a young adult novel. It's obviously, like most young adult or YA novels, it is sort of for everybody.
Yeah.
But the target audience, I guess, that one has in mind when one writes those things is teenagers or whatever. And so you know, sometimes you just don't quite know if the tone is going to match, you know, wherever you might be in your own personal journey. But it's great. So I strongly recommend that. You go to DariusLogan.com is the website for that. DariusLogan.com. DariusLogan.com. You can read David Walker's novel, Darius Logan and Super Justice Force. The first 25 chapters, serialized, I think, 5 per week. Something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, it is 503-505-6964. Thank you for joining us. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. That is rick@rickemerson.com. You can also email Dawn if you like. It's dawn@rickemerson.com. dawn@rickemerson.com. You can get at us, as the young people say, via the text box on the website. You can also message us via Skype. That is Rick Emerson Show. That is Rick Emerson Show. via Skype. That's how you can do that. Coming up today, we got your Democracy in the March. We've also got Clergy Watch coming up today. Mr. Big Jim Willig, who's in the break room right now, preparing with style and grace and efficiency to bring you another installment of Humoria Comedy 101 today, talking about the life and career of Mr. Mel Brooks. Also, the E.H. Bending clue for today. This is the final clue for the week, which means once we give it out, if you are the first person to correctly identify the snack in question, you will win a heaping helping of consumable wonder and goodness from E.H. Vending. Find out more about them at ehvending.com. So clue number 5 coming up. Plus, Dawn Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you on this Friday.
They're celebrating in Cairo. Country music scares a bear away. And a kid's DVD turns out to be porn.
Okay, there you go. And this is all true. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964. Just before we do anything else, so let's see. We mentioned Democracy in the March, Clergy Watch, Humor Me, E.H. Vending Clue number 5. Those headlines. Also, here's a phrase that occurred to me last night. I don't really have anything I can do with this, though. I kicked this around inside my brain for 5 or 6 minutes trying to find an application for this phrase, and there's really nothing I could come up with. That phrase is Ku Klux Clown.
It's certainly evocative.
What would you do with that, though?
You'd create a clown that was had a white sheet and a pointy hat.
I understand.
But he wouldn't all be white because he'd be clown. So,
but that's what I'm saying.
Colorful.
But what would be the application for this phrase or for that creation? I think my wife suggested it as some sort of an edgy Halloween costume, and I said that I probably wasn't going to do that.
See, I was thinking just a clown for white rich kids' birthday parties.
Okay. What kind of a clown are you? I'm a Ku Klux Clown. See, it seems like there's comedy there somewhere, but I can't find it. Yeah. You know what it is? That's like the missing piece meets the big O, the Shel Silverstein thing. So that's the O, but I can't. There's the piece is missing, or vice versa, something like that. Well, anyway, so if you, I'm just going to give that phrase to the people. You all can use that. If you can find an application for that, you just have at it. All right.
Well, in any event.
Let's see. What else do I have here? Oh, and by the way, just in case you were wondering, yes, in fact, my wife's coworkers do have a new nickname for me. So I called my... I have all of these notes about just small little things that happened yesterday, none of which are really like... None of which are really that interesting in and of themselves, just a bunch of little bits and pieces, things that have accumulated like little intellectual flotsam throughout the week. So we got the Ku Klux Clown. Also, so I called my wife yesterday about something or other. Oh, it was about this goddamn refrigerator. Here's the thing about the fridge at my house. Because you were asking why I don't just put everything into coolers or whatever.
Well, that's what you do when you have an emergency like that. The fridge isn't working. The stuff in your freezer is going to thaw. So you go and you get, like, your big thermos coolers, your coolers
your
for camping.
Your igloo chest.
Your igloo chest. And you go to the store, you get a couple of bags of ice, and you put your stuff on ice so that it doesn't rot.
I guess, except that here's the thing. It's not like the fridge just stopped working. See, this is the thing. This is what I was on the phone with my wife about yesterday, and it still hasn't been... There's just so many layers here, I don't even know how to unspool it. It's just like... it's, you know what it is? It's like a ball of yarn made out of an onion wrapped inside a vest. It becomes very difficult to get at the core of the whole thing. And at the center is one of those, like, nuclear golf ball cores. But... It's not just that the fridge stopped working at my house, because keep in mind, we don't own, we rent. And so this is what they call someone else's problem. I mean, it's my problem, but it's not my responsibility, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
This is not mine to fix. This is the landlord's. And I should say, by the way, our landlord is great. I got no issue with the landlord. He's a good guy. Has never given us, we don't have any, we got no quarrel with him. He got no ruckus with us. It's not like we have a sort of contentious or adversarial relationship with the landlord. We do not. But I will say that, and understandably so, he does not like to go out of his way. Like, he's not trying to give himself more work unless he absolutely has to. So if something busts around the house or something just doesn't quite work or something's just giving us a little bit of trouble, he does that thing. He does the tech support thing of talking to us on the phone and trying to do, like, every possible solution he can think of that does not require him actually getting out of his chair and coming to our home. So he'll say, have you turned it off? Have you, like, when our garbage disposal quit working? He's, you know, have you unplugged the garbage disposal underneath the sink? Have you hit the reset button? Have you cleared out the U-joint? Have you put Drano down the sink? Have you checked the fuse box? Have you done, it was like every single possible thing we could think of before he was like, ugh. I'll come out and take a look at it tomorrow. You know, it's not like he's a bad guy. It's just, you know, but this is one of the many things he does. He's got, like, a regular job, and he's got a wife, and he's got kids, and he's got, I think, two other houses that he rents. So it's just, you know, he's just trying not to pile more work on his plate. So we're talking to him about this the refrigerator thing, because I noticed that the things in the fridge were not quite as crisp and cold as they usually are. This is, let's see, what's today? Friday? So like on Tuesday? And it was when I poured myself a glass of milk, and I don't think it had actually gone bad, but it was that thing, because if you're me, you're very finely attuned to the temperature of milk, because I was permanently scarred once when I was a child, because my mom made me drink an entire glass of milk, despite my protest that it tasted funny.
Oh.
And you know the ending to this.
Yeah.
Where it was just like milk, it was like milk-colored Jell-O.
Yeah.
I kept saying, Mom, this tastes weird, there's something wrong, this milk tastes all thick. Which I think is how I phrased it. It was like four. And she said, there's nothing wrong with it. Drink your milk. Shut your head. And I said, fine. And I continued to drink my milk. And then she, of course, sat down across the table from me for breakfast. And she got one swallow into the milk. And she said, well, this does taste kind of weird. And, of course, by that point, I had consumed an entire glass of the milk. And she went and she poured it into the sink. And it just sort of poured out in chunks.
Oh, God.
That was a long time ago. But that's a memory that stays with you. So, as much as I don't ever throw food away, and as much as I will eat pizza out of the trunk of my car, one of the things that I am very, very persnickety about is milk. Not even, and it's not like all dairy products. It is just milk, and it's not like if I leave it out for 5 minutes, I got to throw it away, or if it's like, you know, or if it goes past the expiration date, because that expiration date is the sell-by date. That's not the use-by date. So I do try to be sort of rational about it. But if I even get just the slightest scent of this milk has gone off, I won't drink it. And one of the big clues to that is if it's warm, because that indicates that maybe it has not been kept at the proper temperature.
Yes.
So like on Tuesday, pour myself a glass of milk, and I think, well, this is a little warm. And then I open the fridge, and I kind of put my hand inside, and I go, well, that's weird. Everything in here. It wasn't like it was at room temperature. It was just not very cold. And so the first thing I did was I just checked the dial. And I thought, well, maybe it's just been turned down. So I did that thing in the back. And the dial in the back of the fridge is completely mystifying, because it just says, like, it says colder, but the arrows have sort of, like, been rubbed off over the years to the point that I can't quite tell which way I'm supposed to turn anything. So then it's, like, it's a 50-50 chance. Like, I have no... And there's no, like, numbers or anything. There's just a bunch of dots on the dial. And the dots don't ever appear to get bigger. They don't appear to get bigger or smaller. I think that they were probably just... There was probably, like, some sort of an arrow or, like, a finger pointing in one direction that has just been worn away by years of tenant use. And so now I just have to, like, flip a coin and try to figure out which way I might turn the thing to get the... And here's the other thing. Why do they even give you the option? Why would you not want the... Why would you ever want the fridge to be warmer?
I don't know. I've always wondered why you have that colder thing. Because I was... I always just set it up a little bit higher because it's like, well, if I can make my fridge colder, I will do so.
And things will last longer.
Yeah.
Because I think the argument would be that if the fridge is going to be... If you keep the fridge a little bit warmer, that you're going to save energy. But A, I don't think you're saving that much.
No.
B, it seems like it's going to be a wash because things are going to go bad faster.
And in old fridges, if you turned them up too high, you did run the risk of your freezer getting, like, all full of frost and stuff. But now we have frost-free freezers and don't really have to worry about them.
How do they do that? How does a freezer stay frost-free?
I don't know.
It's magic, I think. That actually is, I think, there's just, like, a small wizard. There's an elf wizard of some kind who lurks inside, like Thornscape Battle Mage from Magic the Gathering. In any event, so... So I'm just
Thornscape that I'm battle fridge, his cousin.
So I'm just turning the dial, and then I check back, you know, later in the night, and it's like the fridge is still, it's exactly the same temperature, nothing has changed. And so then I think, well, this isn't good. So I open the freezer, and the freezer is colder, but it's not actually frozen. In other words, it's right. It's like the ice. I'd put some ice cubes in earlier. I'd use some ice, and I'd fill the trays, and it had like a sheen of ice. You know that thing in the ice cube tray where the top is frozen, but it's still liquid in the center. And I thought, well, Christ! Now the whole thing is just going. It's going wonky. I mean, it's going belly up. So I think, okay, well, you know what? I'll unplug it and I'll just let it sit for a bit, and I'll plug it back in, because that's the key to fixing everything as a computer owner. Like, if you ever run, like, a Windows machine, you just unplug it for a while, plug it back in, and maybe the computer will look on you with greater favor. So I unplug it for a while. That doesn't work. So it's too late to call my landlord, so I call him the next day, and I say, hey, we got this thing going wonky with the refrigerator. And he says, well, have you tried unplugging it? And I said, yes, I have, actually. I did unplug it. Well, have you tried cleaning the coils? And I think he's bluffing at this point, because I don't even know what that means. I'm not even sure that he knows what it means. I don't think refrigerators have coils anymore. I think coils are a thing...
I think they still do.
Where would they be?
They're on the back.
Now, see, here's the thing. You say that, but I looked in the back. No coils.
Oh.
You know what there is? There's a little thing that looks like, because I remember coils as a kid on the back of the refrigerator, like the sort of brass and copper coiling that all the Freon or whatever goes through. I didn't see anything like that. You know, the only thing there was a thing the size of a small loaf of bread that looked a little bit like a radiator, except it was like if the radiator was all one piece, if there were no gaps between the pipes.
Okay.
It sort of looked like an accordion in that it was ridged, but there were no actual spaces or gaps. And I thought, well, I don't think these are coils. I think this is just a compressor or whatever. But you know what? I'll clean it off. So I cleaned it off. The upshot is that I've done everything I can conceivably think of, and the refrigerator hasn't actually stopped working. It's just that it's warm inside, warmer than it should be. The freezer is still colder, but not freezing. So I have now moved. This is all the way to answer your question of why I didn't just put everything in the ice chest.
You moved the food into the freezer.
Yeah, I moved all of the things that could spoil into the freezer. Because it didn't just turn off all at once, and in fact, I didn't really notice it. It seemed like it's probably been degrading over time. The other reason is because that was on Wednesday. It is now Friday, and the landlord is still trying to talk me through alternate solutions on the phone. What about the dial in the back? Have you turned that? I'm like, I turned the dial. Have you turned it the other way? I've turned it the other way. And the problem is the landlord and I are playing this phone tag because he's on a totally different schedule than I am, because his availability is from 11 to 4 every day. And so I'm not really able to do that or to be at home, even if I were able to be on the phone with him. So we're doing it via voicemail. So we get basically one conversation in a day, and it's delayed. It's like I'm listening back to one message, and I'm leaving one message every day. So we are now on the third and a half day of the refrigerator working just well enough to keep things in the freezer from actually going bad. Meanwhile, the things in the refrigerator, you know, things that you don't really think need to be refrigerated right away, like your celery, you know, like those have actually now started to go bad. So now I can't actually, I have to just now start like moving things to the trash because it's just going to be. So moving things to an igloo would have been pointless because I would have been now on like 4 days of keeping everything in like an igloo chest in the kitchen. And then you're just an Eskimo, living in the Appalachians.
You know what probably busted your fridge? All those pizza boxes behind us.
Probably, but see, he's never going to know about that. Is he, Don?
I won't, Don.
That's what I'm saying. So, I realize nobody cares about this but me, but now it's just this whole thing of, and here's the thing about the fridge, too, is that the fridge is a little bit of, it's a little bit of magic. We always refer to Thomas Keel as being advanced technology and magic because Arthur C. Clarke said any advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And I used to just, this is a thing I used to go on and on about to Joni DeRoshi, and she finally just got sick of hearing me say it, and she told me to shut up because she said it was wrong and that she was tired of hearing me talk about it regardless. But I said, did you ever think how amazing it is that you can control the weather in your home? You know, that you have an air conditioner, you can make it cold inside. 500 years ago, the richest, most powerful man on Earth could not lower the temperature 1 degree. He couldn't make it hotter. He couldn't make it colder. He had people waving palm fronds. That's about it. The most powerful man in Babylon could not control the temperature. I can go home, you know, dirt poor folk, go home, turn on the air conditioner. It gets cold. You can control the weather in your house. That's goddamn amazing. Or the fact that you have a lamp, or we have, you know, you have a miniature sun in the center of your room that you can turn on and off. The darkness comes, you can vanquish it instantly without creating any real amount of heat. I mean, that's just freaking amazing when you think about it. Also, the fact that you got a refrigerator. You have a miniature section of your home in which it is a completely different climate.
Yeah.
And that's sort of great. But you know what? It's so great and it's so widespread that we just don't really think about it until the refrigerator stops working. And then you realize not only how screwed you are without it, because now, I can't eat anything out of the fridge because that has now officially just passed the point of, like, I don't want to put that in my mouth. The freezer is becoming dangerously crowded with things, and I think I'm overworking the freezer, which was already at the point of not being able to actually freeze stuff. Plus, I can't purchase any additional food that might need to be refrigerated. And then also it's like the thing is just starting to reek.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just a whole lot of, it's just a weird.
It's a trial.
It really is.
It's like what Job went through, really.
It's worse than cancer, Don. There's just no getting around it. I hate to just put it in such stark terms, but that is the reality. No man has suffered as I am suffering now.
No.
Hey, how's Patrick, by the way?
Well, he might have cancer. Ah.
No.
Don't you feel bad?
I have egg on my face.
Oh no, we went to OHSU this morning and talked to this doctor, and because they've never been able to figure out what happened to him, they are still concerned that there might be some kind of cancer.
So the thing is, now, I'm not disagreeing with that statement, but here's I have a question. You say that they don't quite know what happened to him, which I believe, yet they removed his gallbladder and the symptoms went away. So they must have some notion.
The symptoms went away, but his renal abilities, the stuff that's going on with his kidneys and his liver particularly, are still not right. They've been they take blood tests and they look at all of the stuff that's going on, and there are just some wonky numbers that just aren't right. Because there was this blockage. There's a blockage in his liver, which they were unable to get the scope into to take a good look at this bile duct in his liver. And then and there may or may not be something on his pancreas. They don't know. But so
something like a growth of some a mass.
So we have graduated from and the thing is, in the meantime, he feels fine. He feels great. He feels back to 100%, frankly. He's happy as a clam. But we had this appointment with this fancy liver doctor at OHSU this morning, and they sent back a rather scary scary pamphlet called
Your Malignant New Pal.
Liver resection. Because the thing is, if they may not have to operate on him, but if they do operate on him, they're probably going to take out a chunk of his liver.
And is it because they think the chunk of the liver, so they're going to take out what they think would be the problem area?
Yeah, because they may end up having to go into biopsy regardless.
Is that what resection is? Is that just cutting a chunk off?
Yeah, I think it's just a word. They make it sound better than, I guess.
Liver carving sounds unfortunate.
Yeah. Yes. It's
so when will you know if this is a thing they have to do?
They're going to be calling us, and he's going to be making appointments for another round of things like MRIs and
that'll be fun.
And stuff. And in the meantime, I was at the hospital today and just ended up entertaining myself because we were there forever.
You sent me this text message this morning.
God.
Dawn, this is a great thing. I get this message from Dawn this morning. It says, it's like at 11:25 and we'll probably show up just in nick of time for show. We'll also be hectic and pissed, FYI. So, yeah, and you were not, by the way.
The appointment was for 9, and we were led to believe it was going to be just sort of a sit down with the doctor and talk about stuff. And it turned into sitting with one of the doctor's minions who went over every square inch of his chart to date, because apparently he hadn't looked at it before we got there, and then making us recount everything that has happened to this point while he took extensive notes. And then he goes away, and then we sat there in the little room and waited for 45 minutes waiting for the fancy liver doctor to actually show up.
Right.
And then she came in with two other guys, and then we all talked. Then she went away, and we waited again. And there's this point where it's like, okay, we've been here for 2.5 hours, and I have to go to work. You know, it's like, so we ended up having this discussion where it was like, well, you know, I could just drive to work, and you could take the tram across, and I'm sure there's someplace you could pick up a bus and get to the office. Yeah. But anyway, we finally got out and got there. But while I was there, of course, one of the best things about having the iPhone is the ability to use it to entertain myself when I'm bored. So, like, there are a series of photographs on Facebook of Patrick laying on the thing and doing stuff. And also things that I just saw in the room that amused me. Like, there's a bottle of antiseptic hand stuff that you're supposed to use when you come and go out of the room. And it says in the bottle, I guess this is the clever tagline for the product. It says, destroys bacteria, not your skin.
Is there an alternate product that actually just, like, are you washing with a cheese grater otherwise?
Yeah, I figured that was nice to know. Thank you for letting me know that. Yeah, when I was talking to Patrick about it, I said, well, it is manufactured by 3M. And I'm sure that's probably a question that comes up at 3M all the time. Is like, okay, there's a new glue for the Post-its. Does this destroy anyone's skin?
Where was this in the in the waiting room bathroom, or was it in the hospital?
It was in a
lab room or something.
It was in the room that we were in, and it was just on a thing by the door.
I bet what this is then. I bet this is in replacement of one of those pre-surge scrubs that doctors have used over the years, because those things are notoriously toxic. I mean, not toxic, but I mean, those things are really, really harsh on your skin.
The new thing with the hospitals now, I've noticed it the whole time that when Patrick was in at Legacy and in here, is they do have these new policies to keep you from spreading any kinds of germs or infections that on, like, both sides, at every single doorway in the facility, there is some kind of an antiseptic thing.
Like a Purell thing.
Every time you come in, anytime anybody comes and goes out of a room, you know, they use the stuff. But I just thought, you know, and it also, you know, it's like it's two sentences with a period after each one. It's like very specific.
The great thing about the phrase destroys bacteria, not your skin, is, again, is that you know that there's a lawsuit or a story of some kind behind that. Like, somewhere there's a photograph of a woman, you know, who's, like, at a deposition, and she's just holding her hands out, and it's just, like, in her hands just ended a bunch of pointy bones. And she said, well, so this is really upshot of this. This is the new soap at work.
Do you have a product that doesn't destroy skin? Maybe, and why don't you put that on the label?
Something a little less thorough would be useful here.
And the other thing is, because I am 12 years old at heart, there was a little plastic thing. It has some kind of a device, I think, for jamming down someone's throat. So you can do CPR on them if they're not breathing.
Different device.
A different thing. And for some reason, I guess so that no one will screw with it unless they need it.
Is this the thing so that if you're giving CPR, the guy can't vomit into your mouth?
Yeah, so they don't have to put their mouth directly on the person's mouth, and it makes it easier. But for some reason, I guess they don't want you touching it or something. It's in a little plexiglass box with a door with a little red tag on it to keep it sort of semi-locked. And I had to, because here's the instructions on what to do. If you would read that aloud, please.
To open, grasp handle, pull out with jerking motion. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just had to
technology and science.
I had to take a picture of that.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We'll do a few news stories here in a second. We got Mr. Big Jim Willigan. He's going to be here with another installment of Humor Me. Comedy 101. Also, a final clue for this week's Name That Snack contest. Brought to you by EH Vending. Clergy Watch. Oh, somebody said you never got to your wife's new nickname. It's not my wife's new nickname. Speaking of hospitals, though, we can actually just bring this full circle. So I call my wife at the hospital where she works. It's that thing. It was almost like a sort of a Seinfeld episode where it was something that I would never have known about or been privy to, but I happened to just overhear a conversation with her and somebody else. So I call my wife to tell her about the latest with the refrigerator and the landlord and the whatever and the rotting food that now fills our kitchen at home. And this guy, she's got this, I don't even want to talk about it. She's got this coworker who answers the phone. Anyway, this guy, Jim. And so Jim answers the phone. And he says, 9A. And I say, hi, is Lara there? And he goes, is it her husband? I said, yes, it is. Can I talk to her, please? And he goes, yeah, hold on a second. And he does the thing of putting his hand over the phone. And I don't know whether it's that he thought he was muting the phone by putting his hand over it. And he just didn't realize that doesn't really work, like pressing an actual mute button. Or he was really knowing that he was aware that I would hear this, but he wanted to feign that he was being tactful. And he said, this is apparently now my new nickname at work, with my wife's work, for everybody. This is how I'm referred to. Hey, Lara, Mr. Won't Let You Buy a Big Screen TV is on the phone. And apparently that's not just him, and it's not just that one time. That has now become the name by which I am referred by everybody at her workplace. So I'm no longer Rick. I'm not even really husband, anything. I am just Mr. Won't Let You Buy a New TV.
Huh.
There you go. So if you ever need to get a hold of me and I'm at Lara's work, you just call and ask for Mr. Won't Let You Buy a New TV, and they'll find me. Just in case you were curious about that. At the news desk, it is Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
A Queens, New York mother received a shockingly graphic surprise when the DVD she purchased for her child turned out not to be cartoons as advertised, but hardcore pornography. Candace Connor brought her 3-year-old son Logan to Toys R Us, and he was begging for Diego. He said, I want Diego. So she bought the DVD Nickelodeon All-Star Sports Day for $12.99, which featured the character from Diego from Dora the Explorer on the cover. The next day, she asked her 11-year-old son to put the movie in for his little brother, and that's when the trouble started. She said, I hear Mom. I was like, what's going on? And I go inside, and I'm shocked. The Queen's mother immediately realized that the G-rated cartoon was actually an X-rated hardcore porn flick, which turned out to be titled Bubble Butt Bonanza Number 17.
Awesome.
Which included men and women having sex. She said, it was just terrible too much for me as an adult. So imagine that it's for children.
Well, probably worse as an adult, because as an adult, you have the good sense to be horrified by what you're seeing. As a kid, you just wonder what all the undulating's about.
Well, the DVD box was shrink-wrapped in plastic, appeared to be real, and had a printed barcode. The receipt matches the information on the DVD box, but the disc itself was white with no title printed on it.
Well, this is just, but doesn't this happen with astonishing regularity in one form or another? I mean, like once a month at least, don't, and this is just, these are just the ones we choose to read. Isn't some story about, and I called the customer service number and it was really a gay sex hotline, you know, or something, or it's, you know, you pull the string and the doll, instead of saying change me, says up yours, dad. It's, I mean, the number of times in which pornography, or there'll be that thing of where, you know, what was supposed to be religious or news programming on a Sunday morning ended up being hardcore pornography after a janitor. I mean, the substitution of pornography, which is way better than getting Folgers crystals, I might add, in place of a normal thing, seems to happen all the time. It's right up there with that flower that smells like rotting flesh.
Yes. Nothing like that has ever happened to me, and I kind of wish it would. I'm just sort of shocked. There used to be
now,
a lot...
we've given you porn here. You've received it, and you choose not to watch it.
No, but that's not the same thing as buying a Nickelodeon Dora the Explorer DVD and turning out that, surprise, you get Bubble Butt Bonanza number 17.
Are you saying you wish that that would happen more often?
I kind of do. I kind of...
You buying a lot of Dora the Explorer DVDs?
No, maybe that's the problem. I need to buy more.
Is that to decorate the manacle room downstairs?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. Let's do two more here, and we'll take care. By the way, and just here's what's not helpful. This, you're making the problem worse by opening the refrigerator door.
You can't get your stuff in and out if you don't open the door.
Yeah, seriously, what am I supposed to do? Just I wish there was a superhero I could reference. Reach in like.
I don't know.
Anything? Is there a guy who can slip between subatomic space?
Oh, obviously there must be.
Well, whatever. I mean, what am I going to do? Wish the things out of there? Hold on a second. Let me send my bratwurst to the cornfield.
And so, really, it's like a Schrodinger's cat thing. I mean...
How do I know the things are rotting? Maybe they're not rotting.
Maybe they're perfectly fresh.
Maybe they're in...
You don't know until you open the refrigerator.
And maybe they're in the freezer and in the refrigerator at the same time, and I'm just unaware of it. Really, that, you know what's like Schrodinger's cat is that light in the refrigerator. That's where you just. When I was a kid, I would try to open the fridge as quickly as I possibly could to try to catch it being dark inside, and I was never really sure whether it was dark inside or not.
Didn't anybody show you the little button
when I was like three?
Oh, okay.
So yes, last week, Don. But here's another comment that doesn't help. Let's just list some of the things that don't help you. Here's another one. Hey, you know, if your fridge is fairly modern, the coils may be on the bottom of the fridge. Well, what in the name of Christ is that about? Why would you possibly put the coils where they can't be accessed by anybody? Including, by the way, the guy who would come to fix the fridge, unless he's got 12 friends that are going to help him tip the thing. Why would the coils be on the bottom of the fridge, and why would that be better?
Yeah, especially if you're supposed to clean them.
That's just ridiculous. All right. Well.
Okay. I got an email, by the way, from our listener, Dallas, who wanted to remind us that tomorrow is the day he's going to be doing the polar bear plunge for the Special Olympics. So it's not too late if you want to sponsor him in the Polar Plunge. You can go to Facebook and search for Dallas Takes the Polar Plunge. He's actually done a Tiny Earl. So you can go to tinyearl.com/Dallas Polar Plunge. And that will take you to his page. So
is Tiny Earl a cartoon character?
I always thought that the Tiny Earl place should actually have...
What is the Tiny Earl place? Is that like a muffler repair shop? Tiny URL?
Yes.
Okay. Don't say Tiny Earl because no one knows that. It's like calling it the OC.
Oh, all right.
Don't do that.
Well, tinyurl.com. And it's one of those places where you put in a big, long URL and it turns it into a small URL. But
I know what it is, but no one calls it Tiny Earl.
I've always thought they should actually have... a mascot
Hi, folks, I'm Tiny Earl.
His name is Tiny Earl.
Welcome to my place where everything gets made smaller.
Yes. He's like a little guy, and he's wearing, like, overalls.
I figured it out. Okay. All right.
Okay. A plumber checking on some frozen pipes in a crawl space at a cottage in Boulder, Colorado, was surprised last week when he suddenly heard growling. He waved his flashlight around and saw a bear. The bear had apparently decided to hibernate in the crawl space of the cottage, which was only used occasionally by hospital employees at Boulder Community Hospital. State wildlife officials were called in to get rid of the bear. They decided the best approach was to make the environment noisy, so they put a boombox in the crawl space and played country music. The bear was gone the next morning.
Awesome. That's fantastic. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. By the way, we've got this from listener Jenny. Don, when I was up at OHSU when I had the cancer, first thing I did was give up on any sort of quick service. Even now that I'm in remission and I go every 6 months for a checkup, the visit is a, yes, three-hour ordeal.
Okay, that's good to know.
So that's sort of good news, bad news.
Yeah.
I guess it's not, there's really no good news there.
At least I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Okay.
Did you have a clergy watch for me?
Yes, I do, but I've also got this guy saying, who needs a fridge anyway? That's old technology. Am I just supposed to be eating, like, space food now?
What
is everything
he,
just supposed to be pills on my plate and some freeze-dried ice cream?
Is this guy, like, just spraying his food down with liquid nitrogen or something? I mean, what do you mean old technology?
I have no idea. All right. Yeah, I got nothing. Listener Rick wants us to know that I opened a Diet Dr. Pepper and was horrified when I realized it was full of hardcore pornography.
Oh, he was not horrified at all.
Let's do, did we already do two or did we do one? Well, let's break now.
Yeah.
We'll take a break. We'll come back on the other side with Mr. Big Jim Willig. He's going to be here with another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. Today we're talking about Mr. Mel Brooks. Mel Brooks he'll be talking about. Also, Clergy Watch, Democracy on the March, and the final clue for this week's Name That Snack. That is all the way. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program right here at the Emerson News Network. Go nowhere, my friends.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
You are listening to the sweet soul sounds of the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964.
Yes. Ooh, baby.
See, and I can't do it now because I was... because it didn't sound creepy. I was just about to do that,
I can feel the love.
I was about to do that thing from the Commitments where Joey Fagan is going, I want to be your everything. But see, now it would sound weird following up on your sort of guttural moaning that just there.
Girl, you look fine tonight. Okay. Oh, yeah.
Never mind. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for joining us. If you want to email, you can do that as well. It's rick@rickemerson.com, rick@rickemerson.com, or Dawn, D-A-W-N, @rickemerson.com. Still to come, we got your clergy watch, also Democracy in the March, and we are joined now by Mr. Big Jim Willig, who's here
Big
with another installment
Jim.
Of...
How you doing, baby? Yeah.
Thank you. Hello.
Here's what I was going to say a second ago. And then I wasn't going to do it, but now I will because it actually ties into this week's Outlook Portland, on which you and your friend Don Frost, who's hilarious, by the way.
Oh, yes.
Now, is he really British? Is that a thing? Was he born in Britain and then he moved here? Because he didn't have an accent, or he didn't have much of an accent.
No, he...
Was he screwing with me?
He screws with you, yeah. He's actually from a little town called Mina, Nevada.
Okay, so I couldn't quite tell, though, because, I mean, those teeth. It's not like... because he goes...
The chiclets?
We should back up for a second. So this coming Sunday in Outlook Portland, we're going to be talking about what it's like to be a stand-up comic, and specifically in Portland. And so Jim is the guest along with this guy, Don Frost, who I had not met, but I said, you know, if you want to bring in somebody else, you know, that you think would you know, have something to contribute to this, you know, just feel free. You have carte blanche. And so you brought this guy, Don, who I had not met, but who was really, really funny. But at one point I said something about, I don't remember what it was, but I said something about, you're a bad American. And he said, well, that's because I'm not from America. I was born in Britain. And I just bought it like hook, line, and sinker, because as soon as he said that, I looked at the teeth and I went, oh, my God, he's right. He was totally born in Britain. Because they were just, he was like a Basil Wolverton drawing. They were just like, you know, and I went, oh, it all makes so much sense now.
He's also a cutter, so I hope you're happy now. He's probably somewhere just carving your name into his left forearm.
I thought I was pretty. we taped this Outlook Portland on, I guess it was it Monday or Tuesday? I guess it was Tuesday.
Tuesday, yeah.
And so you stuck around, and you saw, because most people, they'll come in for the Outlook Portland taping, and we do four interview segments. And then there's all this other stuff. I do a little opening, and I do there's a commercial we do for our fine sponsor, Things From Another World, TFAW.com. And we do an editorial reply. And the editorial reply, if anybody's, if you've seen this in its produced version, when you finally see it, it's a figure, or I think there's a Magic the Gathering card, actually Thornscape Battle Mage, but there's usually a figure of some kind, of an action, you know, an action figure or a superhero or a sci-fi character that we have sitting at the table, and it does the thing of looking at camera one, camera two, but it is then an editorial reply, an editorial response delivered as that character. And so I'll record it, and then they'll lower my voice, or they'll modulate my voice, or whatever. And so it'll be this week's editorial reply by Godzilla, or Megatron, or
Paul Stanley Rubber Duck.
Paul Stanley of Kiss as a rubber duck, which, by the way, that comes from my own collection. And so I got this email from Cheryl yesterday saying, it is really time, by the way, that we find a new – that we augment the lineup by finding a new character or sci-fi personality to deliver the editorial reply. We've got to, you know, freshen up the lineup. And I know this is why, because she hates the Paul Stanley as a rubber duck thing, because that's the one that I always default to. When in doubt, I always go to Paul Stanley. I'll find one actually later on, maybe this hour, and play it. And it won't be quite the same hearing it without the visual, because the visual, have you seen the rubber duck?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've seen the Outlook Portland thing where you cut between camera one and camera two with the extreme close-up of the Paul Stanley rubber duck with your background going,
Miss in Portland!
Mass transit in Portland is important! Woo! Yeah.
And it's pretty great, not because of me, but just because Paul Stanley is, and that's exactly what it sounds like, by the way. Kiss put out a line of rubber ducks a few years ago where they all had like the cod pieces and the makeup and the whatever. And But each of the characters that I do for the editorial reply, they each have their own sort of shtick or their own gimmick. Godzilla is always talking about the arts. Thernscape Battle Mage from Magic the Gathering is always pissed off about parking. Megatron often starts out really, really calm, but ends up really angry, and then he ends with which I think I nicked from Morbo, but he always ends with "I will destroy you." But the thing about the Paul Stanley character, the Paul Stanley Rubber Duck character, is that no matter what the subject is on the show, every single time his editorial reply ends with him comparing that day's subject to the love of a fine-looking lady.
Oh, yes.
And I got to tell you, every week as I'm like writing the Outlook Portland script, that is the moment that takes the longest, is I will sit there in my home office for like 10 minutes staring at the ceiling thinking, how are library books like the love of a fine-looking lady? Christ.
How are they not like a love of a fine-looking lady?
Yeah, it's just like I have to pace around and just go, okay, wait, hold on. Open home pages, binder. No, I got nothing. And I'll have to sit there and I'll just have to go out to freestyling out, you know, in the living room, pacing back and forth throughout the house, trying to come up with however like parking meters are like the love of a fine-looking lady. And the reason that I do that is because it makes Cheryl cringe. So this is a long way to go to get to that revelation. But that's what I do, because it makes Cheryl cringe every time. And I think she said that she actually has to mute the show when she watches it back when the Paul Stanley Duck comes on. So that's why I have to keep doing it.
Maybe because she just wants to see the Paul Stanley Duck without your voice in the background. She has a Puritan's...
She can't enjoy it.
Yeah, enjoyment of Paul Stanley.
So we need to come up with... So at some point, I got to come up with another character to add to the editorial reply lineup. The only thing is it can't be somebody who has a really recognizable voice as the actual character. Now, you could argue that like Megatron or Paul Stanley have a recognizable voice, but not in the same way that like Darth Vader does or something. Like, you can't fake the Darth Vader voice, you know, without it being corny.
God knows you don't want this segment to come off as corny.
It's the right kind of corn, Don. It's a high quality corn. And plus, let's be honest, I mean, I can do me a passable Paul Stanley or even Superman, who does not have one specific voice tethered to him. You screw. But it's like if you try to do like, you know, the like Han Solo or something, it's just going to be that would be lame.
You should have a I think you need to get a female editorial character in there somewhere.
OK, no, I'm with you. I'm with you on that. Here's the only thing, though. It's got to be something that it's got to be something that Things from Another World has in stock as either a figure, preferably a figure, so you can get the 3D shot of it looking at the camera. So it's got to be a female character that they have in stock that I could get some shots of.
How is your Japanese schoolgirl anime voice?
Offensive, Hentai. I would imagine.
Because they have a lot of, like, you know...
Racist? Why do you ask?
They have a lot of Sailor Moons and things like that. And so you could get...
passable, I guess. And probably...
Well, like Emily Strange, that's a good, like, middle of the
Yeah, you could do road. You could do an emo chick.
Now see Emily Strange. That's the very strange. She's the girl with the lank black hair that does. Yeah. Is that a comic book character?
It's not really. It's really actually just a character that was created.
I only see
for
her on
products.
Like
it's like a little emo primer for girls.
I just see she's like a Hello Kitty sort of the goth world, right?
Yeah.
Because I only ever see her on like handbags.
Because it goes like from Taylor Swift, and then once they hit the moody age, then they go to Emily Strange.
All right, I could.
Just an idea.
I think there's maybe.
They also have the Living Dead dolls, like I collect, and there's a line of Dia de los Muertos ones. So you could do an offensive Hispanic accent.
I was just going to say, when you asked how my Sailor Moon was, I said offensive. It's really no more offensive than anything else. No more than Paul Stanley just basically talking about, you know, about a book as though it were a woman he was trying to get back to his apartment for a night of illicit sex. So, you know, I mean, really, it's all, you know, you say tomato.
I check you out.
Yeah. Well, in any event. Hello, Big Jim. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Or as we call him now, Big Hunk.
That's right.
And I realized yesterday, I think we were having this discussion, that Tom Likas' name for his male member is, in fact, Big Jim.
Okay.
Not making that up. Big Jim and the Twins.
Oh, great. Yeah. Thank you. So. I can never look at my member in the mirror ever again without listening to the sultry sounds of Tom Likas.
Yeah. So this Sunday, though, you really ought to watch Outlook Portland because so Jim and his friend Don Frost are on there talking about the art of a stand-up comedy, and it's really, really good. I'm not just saying that because it's like a me thing. It was really fantastic. And the reason I had the reason that I had you pick somebody that you thought was interesting to come on is because, and I've said this before, that one of the reasons that I don't like interviewing comics most of the time is they just want to do shtick.
Yeah.
Which is fine. I mean, it's like not like you can't be funny, but it's also – but it's like interviewing somebody in character.
Yeah.
That's another thing. That's why that – that is why, really, it doesn't matter. You could have everybody I have ever known or cared about in a warehouse somewhere strapped with C4, and I am not going to interview the famous, mysterious, goddamn actor. It's never going to happen. It's never going to happen, ever, ever, ever. I would rather have my legs sawed off.
For some reason, you actually did his show.
I didn't do his show.
I thought you did.
No.
I could have sworn. No. I know Mike Russell has been
on his show. I have declined the interview. And I'm not saying that like I'm too
it's
big.
No, it was that other guy. You did the other guy's show.
I did Ed Foreman show.
You had Ed Foreman.
I did Ed Foreman show. I did Ed Foreman show because I have because I know the guy Aaron Ross who does the Ed Foreman character, and he'd come on Outlook Portland. He had agreed to do Outlook Portland, and that was. I'm not saying it was a quid pro quo, like it was drudgery. It's not like it was a huge torture to do it. But that was, you know, he came on my show, I went on his show, and you know, and I kind of knew him sort of out of character, whatever. Plus, here's the other thing though, the reason that I went on the Ed Foreman show is because. When Aaron Ross, who is Ed Foreman, and that is is it every Tuesday? I think Tuesdays, every Tuesday at Dante's, I believe.
Yeah.
I don't think it's once a month, but it's every Tuesday at Dante's. He does a sort of faux late night show. The reason that I went on his show, one of those reasons, is because when he came on Outlook Portland, he agreed to do the interview out of character. Like, he didn't insist on coming on Outlook Portland and being Ed Foreman. We had some clips of that, but he came on as just Aaron Ross. Whereas, like, you know, what's his name? The famous guy. It just, you know, like his whole thing is just to come on and talk in a squeaky voice.
Yeah, I don't know if you ever remembered from the old days at the CBS station, the few times that we had him in the studio, it was always like, you know, herding retarded cats having him on because we'd have him arrive at one entrance and he would subsequently show up at the other entrance just to be difficult, in character, in costume, wandering around the side of the building where, like, there's nothing but chain-link fence and, like, trees and hobos sleeping. And he just come wandering by and, like, sort of banging on the windows of, like, Paddock's office.
And squeaking at you.
Yeah, making, like, weird animal noises. And I'm just like, oh, great. Thank you very much. I'm just going to – I can hear the referral now getting written in my name.
Yeah. I would rather have my skin taken off with a rusty fish scaler. There's just no – there is no way. Anyway, so but this coming Sunday, Jim Willig and Don Frost will be the guests on Outlook Portland. And it really is. You guys really. I was actually impressed and surprised at how great the interview was in the sense that, like when we talked about bombing on stage, and Don Frost tells this story about being in a comedy competition, and he makes it all the way to the final round, and at the final round. He said he just choked. He just bombed miserably. And I think you said you were actually there.
Yeah, and it was seriously, it was something painful to watch. Because Don on stage is, he's an enigma. He can roll with just about anything you put in his way. But the acoustics were just so wretched for this. And it was like a three-tiered Coliseum-style seating that he couldn't get anything intelligible out to the audience. So he could have had the best material of his life that he's cranking out there, but no one be able to understand what he was saying.
And if you can't get the crowd's response, if you can't gauge, if you can't hear what they're responding to, and there's a certain timing and a rhythm to when the laughter stops and you start talking again, and it is sort of like surfing in a way. You're knowing how to ride the response of the crowd. And if they can't really hear you all that well, and if you can't hear them all that well, then you're just hosed. That's like 90% of it.
Yeah, you're just plummeting to earth at a high rate of speed.
It was a really – and he actually said, and I don't doubt it for a moment, he said that after bombing and this final round, the finals of this comedy competition, that he said that he woke up in a cold sweat every night for just weeks, where he would actually have these sort of strange nightmares where he would wake up going, here's what I should have done. And it was, and his girlfriend would be like, what? And he's like, I know the joke I should have told. And then he would fall back asleep. And, you know, and I have no doubt that that's true. So it really is, it was an interesting interview, sort of a look at the inner workings of comedy. So that is this coming Sunday, 6:30 on the CW cable channel 3, or you can also get it online at OutlookPortland.com a couple days after it airs. So like Monday, Tuesday, it'll be up at OutlookPortland.com and so forth. Hello, Don Taylor.
Hi.
Are you ready to do some news?
Sure.
Let's do some news.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Two small dogs are being monitored under home quarantine after chewing their elderly owner's toes off early Thursday.
Okay.
Police in San Diego received an emergency call just before 5:30 a.m. from the man's housemate and caretaker.
The caller sounds like we're really doing a Cracker Jack job of that, too.
The caller said he found the victim, 72-year-old Frank Rose, lying in bed amid blood-soaked sheets at their home.
Rose, are you okay? Okay. I'm going to be watching Days of Our Lives.
The caretaker then discovered that his roommate was missing three left toes and that one of the men's two small dogs had blood on its snout.
Wow.
George Chilson said, I pulled off the sheets and looked at his foot and I dialed 911. Paramedics took Rose, who seemed confused about how he had suffered the injuries, to a hospital.
So wrong to laugh at this. I feel so bad.
Rose, whose right leg and one of his toes on his left foot had been previously amputated, suffers from neuropathy, a type of nerve damage that has left him with no feeling in his remaining foot.
Okay, so it's but not his like foot he, is so delicious.
It's not like he had dementia. It's that he literally couldn't feel it.
Yes.
It was like his foot was numb.
Right.
And so he just looked down. And
he was asleep.
Hold on.
And the guy woke him up and was like, dude, your toes.
That's the strangest dream. The Queen of Sheba was nibbling at my toes.
But this is really strange, though, because it's, okay, leaving aside the fact that he doesn't have any sensation in his toes, how would the dogs have ever gotten it into their heads that, like, well, we should just eat part of that guy?
Well,
send a message.
I mean, yeah, what is
the Molly Maguires?
Dogs will actually lick and chew at wounds, and they'll do it on their owners as well.
But he wasn't injured, it doesn't say. It sounds like they caused the injury.
Yeah, but because he suffers from whatever it is that's causing the neuropathy. I mean, he's already had.
Oh, that's true. If he already had one amputated.
He's already had toes amputated on his other foot.
Okay, so.
So there might be
blood in the water, so to speak.
They may have just smelled like.
They smelled,
you know,
the death on him.
Like delicious curing sausages or something.
Like the cat that knows if you have cancer or not.
Totally.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Well, why is it that his other foot was amputated? Was it amputated? Do you have like a canary with a taste for human blood?
Anyway, officers filed the report. Animal control officers placed the two Cavalier King Charles Spaniels under quarantine at the house. The dog's owners does not want the dogs destroyed.
The end.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Chilson says he believes the dogs were trying to heal a sore on Rose's foot. Said, occasionally he can get a nick on his foot, and I think what happened is they found a scab on his toe and began licking and chewing.
Okay. You're listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. It is Friday, February 11th, 2011. Here is Don Taylor.
Are you sure you don't want to hear that yogurt story?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Okay.
Here's the thing. It's not even that I really care. It's just that I'm the one who I hear about it later. I get emails like, so I was eating lunch, and then it's like we just caused some sort of an upset in.
Okay. Because it's 2:30 in the afternoon now, so, you know, it's like. Nah.
Really?
I love this story.
Okay, here's the thing. Why are you so bent on telling this story? I would think that you. Now we almost have to reveal it because now we're talking about it.
The hype is just too high.
And don't think that I don't know that that was part of your cunning plan the entire time. During Legion of News, we had the most horrifying story about a man. I apologize now. Here's the thing. I'm going to say something horrifying in just a moment. And then Dawn will give you an even more horrifying version of the same story. But we had the story during Legion of News about a man whose precious male essence was given to a shopper. Under the guise of being a new and tasty kind of yogurt.
Okay.
Now, Dawn chose to read this during the lunch hour, and I was doing like the I was doing the semaphore of like the, you know, like, no, you're too low, left bank, you know, pull the ripcord, and
negative ghostwriter pattern is full.
Yeah. So
we do a new news show. The news must be read.
Yeah.
I don't know. Are you all bent on doing that, like, now?
Well,
let's just get it done then. Let's just pull the Band-Aid off.
Okay. The DNA of 31-year-old Anthony Garcia was matched to semen found in yogurt in Albuquerque, New Mexico, the Associated Press reported yesterday. Police first responded to a 911 call at an Albuquerque grocery store on January 26th that the woman spit out a yogurt sample she was given from a store employee.
Oh, she's a spitter.
And said she thought instead it was bodily fluid.
Because that would be gross.
As it turns out, the woman's hunch was right. So it's unclear how it happened.
It may have fallen out of his pocket.
Here's the thing. I was making yogurt naked, which is my want. And just so happened, I get a little agitated, a little excited. At least, because there's really only two foods you can pull that off with. And obviously the other one would be, you know, mayonnaise. So it's just a little bit harder to sort of work your way into it, like a dairy product.
Yeah. So, he was taken away in handcuffs, and not for this, by the way. Once he, that's something interesting that was not in the previous version of the story I read, because yes, they did determine that yes, indeed, the yogurt sample did contain or was completely comprised of his manly essence. But it turns out they arrested him because he also had outstanding warrants for child molestation, kidnapping, and bribery.
So they're just running up the scoreboard here. They're just spiking the ball.
So he's I think he's just looking for new things to get arrested for at this point.
What was the name of the store?
I didn't say.
Okay. Just checking.
Actually, it's in the other story, but I don't know. It had some like happy name. It was like Sunflower Food Mart or something like that.
I believe it was because this email says, was he the seed in the sunflower?
So there you go.
That's all right. Okay. Are you happy now? Put a smile on your evil little face, Don?
Yeah. That makes me, I'm happy.
Black heart full of joy. Is it?
We now return you to your banana cream pie eating contest.
There is Don Taylor at the news desk.
Well, I think that the only possible segue now is to move on to our clergy watch.
Here's your clergy watch for Friday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Well, I guess it would be nice if I could touch your body. I know not everybody has got a body like you. Cause I gotta have faith.
Here is Don Taylor with your clergy watch.
Three priests and a Philadelphia Catholic school teacher are facing charges of rape and assault against two young boys over a period of several years. District Attorney Seth Williams says a fifth man, Monsignor William Lynn, is charged with child endangerment for allegedly allowing the abuse to continue by reassigning them to new parishes.
I'm sorry, this is Clergy One?
Yes.
Without telling the pastor, without telling the principals of these schools that these pedophiles, that these known abusers of children were in such close proximity to more children.
Here's the thing about it is that the Monsignor is sort of like the numb toes on the body of the church. And I have just never known a Monsignor who wasn't just blitzed out of his mind all the time on cheap gin and reeking of bad cigars.
Yeah.
So it's like, I mean, really, you could have just set fire to the place most days and they would have only been partially aware of what was going on.
Philadelphia's Archbishop Justin Regali had little comment.
It was just released today. The Archdiocese has not yet had the opportunity to review it, and therefore I am not able to comment specifically on its contents.
Here's the thing about this guy is, doesn't this, and I'm not saying anything about the actual behavior of whoever this church mouthpiece is that was just speaking here, but just aesthetically speaking, just in terms of the tone and timbre of his voice, doesn't this sound exactly like a guy who's just sort of, you know, you can just hear this voice sort of wheezing and grunting heavily above you, can't you?
Since the report was just released today, the Archdiocese has...
It is the will of God.
Since the report was just released today, the Archdiocese has not yet had the opportunity to review it, therefore I am not able to comment specifically on its content.
It's like you just hear the locking of doors and the rustling of robes when you hear that voice.
You've been selected for a special midnight novena.
You're a terrible person.
Well, I had the blessing of going to a Catholic school where I was an altar boy and a Boy Scout.
Really? You and how long? How many years were you in a Catholic school?
I got held back twice.
Did you really?
I did, yeah. First grade. I shouldn't really say that because the first grade.
How do you get held back in first grade?
Well, the teacher that I had informed my mother at the very first PTA meeting in like September. She's like, "Your son's not going to pass.
Not going to make it.
Not going to make it." And she's like, "How do you know? We've only been in class for like maybe a month and a half."
Right.
And this teacher later turned out to be physically severely abusive to the students.
Really?
Yeah.
So was the teacher just planning on keeping you around because you were? Were a favorite?
That was the thing. I don't know. She was very very handsy with the kids. She only got in trouble.
When you say physically abusive, you mean like in a sexual way or like in a beating you with a rock kind of a
way?
In a
like throwing a chair at you from across the room kind of way.
Jesus.
And that was the only way, literally. That was the only way that she was ever to get in trouble was she actually broke a window throwing a chair from across the room at a child. So from that point on, my mom took me out of school. I got to spend the rest of like that half year at a public school. And then during that summer, my mom received a notification saying that she'd received the proper counseling required to re-enroll your child in our school to make him feel safe. So we got a year and a half of this. Felt like Gaius Baltar after he got back on Battlestar. You know, just like, I know it's I know the airlock's coming. I don't know what day. But like every time she'd stare at me, she'd give me that look. I'm just like, that's it.
Oh, yeah, because you were the guy that got her in trouble. You're one.
I dimed her out first. And then like I got to see all my other students, like all my other classmates in second grade. And they're just looking at me like, dude, dead man walking.
Well, that was – so what was their – what did the other kids – how did they treat you if it was known that you were the one that got the teacher in trouble? Were you lionized or were you scorned?
I was scorned for two reasons. One, that I had gotten Miss Morrow's in trouble.
So you were. So they thought you were. It was bad that you'd done it, like you were a snitch or something.
And plus, like I also had to deal with the fact that I was being I was viewed as being stupid because I was held back a year.
Oh right.
So regardless of the fact that I was completely justified in like, you know, escaping this abuse and then put back into it, they viewed it more as like, you know, well, he's just dumb.
And you're that kid who's like, you know, 5 inches taller than all the other kids in second grade.
No, actually, I was a very small little kid. I didn't hit my growth spurts until like maybe fourth or fifth grade. But until then, I was like Andy Dufresne in the first part of Shawshank. I was getting passed around by the teachers. But not in a sexual way, but more like in a physical kind of way. But no, the priests, the scoutmasters, no one even gave me a second glance. Never been kissed. Nothing. Aww. You know? Never even like an awkward pass after like a camp out or something. Nothing.
Yeah. And I have to say, actually, I mean, I don't know anybody. I do not know of anyone that I went to school with whoever got mishandled by any of the teachers or the priests or whatever. I mean, as widespread as that, we sometimes think that is, I mean, it didn't happen to me, and it didn't happen to my knowledge to anybody that I know.
Well, that's the thing is, you know, at public schools, it's always like a male student and like a female teacher, you know, get involved in some activity.
Always.
And like the teacher's usually fairly attractive. Like the prettiest teacher at my school was Mr. Smith, the music teacher, and he wasn't touching anybody. So it was a different situation in our situation. The only teacher that ever got in trouble for any kind of like bad activity was at St. Joseph's Elementary School. The priest of the parish got in trouble, but he was trying to solicit a female prostitute for sex. And then when the police went back to his rectory, pun intended, they discovered a bunch of like heterosexual pornography. But everybody came out of the woodworks, oh, he's touching our children. I'm like, no, there's no pedophilia, you know, anywhere in this case. There's just a case of a guy who hasn't had any sex.
Wanted to have the sex and isn't allowed to.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, we had a lot of teachers that would like put their hurt on you. That would give you like a, you know, you get the ruler or the knuckles in the back of the head occasionally if you were like sleeping or not paying attention.
Yeah.
Suddenly the teacher would loom up behind you and like poof, like when you're rap you on the back of the head. There wasn't a whole lot of like actual. I wouldn't say that I saw very much actual abuse. Certainly, I don't think I ever received anything that I could consider that. There was a guy named Tim who then later went to prison for Grand Theft Auto. So it does seem like maybe some of this was warranted. Maybe they just did sense. It's like when the chicks start pecking the one weak link. They realize right out it's like a bad apple to begin with. But anyway, Tim at one point shot a rubber band at one of the nuns. Her name was Sister Georgina. He shot a rubber band and it hit. And I think he was just trying to hit her in the back of the head. To be fair, like her back was to the to the class and she was on the chalkboard. He fires the rubber band and I think that he had the bad luck of having her turn around at the wrong moment and it kind of went bam right into the side of the face. And I remember him being taken out into the hallway and there were these concrete walls in the hallway, these brick walls. And I don't really know that this was her intention, but several times he would sort of try to avoid her gaze by looking down, and she would kind of smack his head back up to make him pay attention, but of course then his head would go back into the brick wall, which I remember seeing through this little tiny window in the door. It was one of those weird glass windows that has the steel mesh going through it, kind of like they do at the visitor center at Sing Sing, I think.
Yeah.
And so I remember seeing that, and then the only other incident like that I can ever remember was actually not – it was at a Catholic school, but it was a – what they call a layperson. He was not a priest or a nun. He was the sixth grade teacher who I then had again in eighth grade, and he had been sounds like a joke, but he had been a drill instructor in the Marines, and then he went right.
I was looking for a larger challenge.
Went right from drill instructor to a Catholic school, but at one point there was a kid who was giving him a little lip, as they used to say, and he said, "Harvey, why don't you and I go talk about this in the locker room?" This was in gym class, and so we're all out in the gymnasium, and he says, "Harvey, why don't you and I go discuss this privately?" Which at the time, like you look back now and you think, "Well, that sounds suspicious." Immediately, like, "Why don't you and I go discuss this with no witnesses?" And it's like, you know now, like, well, here's what's going to happen. But I don't think we really Yeah, as kids, I don't think you put that together because we were, I don't know, we would have been, I guess, in sixth grade at that point. So him and Harvey go into the locker room, and Harvey comes out a few minutes later, and he's doubled over in pain. And the teacher actually just says, "So Harvey slipped and fell on a bench inside the locker room. I would hate for that to happen to any of you. So let's not have to have any private talks." Hmm? And wow. We all just went, okay. But, you know, but here's the thing is, strangely enough, like, none of us thought, well, that seems inappropriate. We just thought, like, well, I don't want that to happen to me. I'm going to mind my P's and Q's. Like, it never occurred to me to tell my parents about that because I just figured, well, if you're an a-hole, that's what happens. You know, if you're Harvey the jackass, the guy takes you in the room and wails on you, and so therefore I'm not going to be a jackass.
To this day, the smell of Icy Hot sends Harvey into a panic attack.
By the way, that was the same room, speaking of that locker room and speaking of to this day, that locker room is the same place where you go to have your scoliosis test every year. Did you guys have the scoliosis test?
Oh, yeah.
I guess we did.
And it's like they would, you know, and I guess the deal is they didn't want you to be embarrassed by taking your shirt off, although you have to anyway because it's like at the goddamn locker room at the gymnasium where you have to have gym class and whatever. And so you would go in there one at a time, single file, you would take your shirt off, and then the guy would stand behind you, and he would like, but I remember there was like this doctor, and he would giggle a lot while he was doing it. He would sort of like, he would trace his hands down your back, and again, he never did anything actually sexual or actionable, as far as I know, but he would trace his hands down the middle of your back to presumably be checking your spine, and then he would just sort of giggle to himself. He, you know what he giggled like? He sounded like Tote in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yes, I know you will.
God. Oh, yeah, these are called warning signs.
That time has passed. Here's Don Taylor.
Follow that heat.
Mayor Michael Bloomberg shocked a mostly Irish crowd Wednesday night when he joked about being used to seeing inebriated Irish hanging out the windows of the Irish Historical Society on Fifth Avenue.
Well done.
More than 100 leading Irish Americans had gathered to celebrate the release of the book celebrating 250 years of the New York City St. Patrick's Day Parade by historian John Ridge. Jaws dropped, and some even booed after the mayor made his joke during the beginning of his speech. The stunned crowd included several notable Irish and Irish Americans, including Irish Council General Noel Kilkenny, author Mary Higgins Clark, and St. Patrick's Parade Chairman John Dunleavy. The Irish Central reported that several board members of the society, one of the oldest in the city, were upset by the mayor's remarks. Mayor Bloomberg has since issued a written apology and explained his comment by saying, "I was talking about a party that they have every year on St. Patrick's Day where it's sort of traditional to hang out the window and yell and scream. I said it in good fun. I certainly didn't mean anything that anybody should take offense to."
Okay, now, sorry about that, you mean drunks.
So first of all, I had like three different reactions to this. When you were talking about the joke he told and their reaction to it, my first thing was going to be, well, you know, lighten up. Everybody's just everybody's way too tightly wound in this country. And then when you said he apologized, then I was all ready to bust out on Bloomberg for apologizing and for just, you know, for being spineless about it when he should have just said, like, it's a joke.
But his apology was one of those, well, I'm sorry, but Jesus, get over
it. But then I totally came around at the end. Because it's not really an apology so much as like, well, if you're offended, I guess that's unfortunate, but what are you going to do?
And I'm sorry. I come from a long line of Irish Catholics. We're drunks.
Well, yeah.
And that's the other thing is like, I think, you know, here's the thing. When we reach
Everyone knows we're drunks.
And when we reach a point where 98% of the Irish and St. Patrick-themed merchandise in this country isn't about being drunk and vomiting or starting a fist fight with somebody, then you can bitch about it. But, I mean, I don't think we're at that point. And also, you know—
And, I mean, have you ever been around actual Irish people from Ireland? They're even worse. And, I mean, wow.
And also, they're just jokes. So let's all calm down a little bit, shall we?
Let's have a drink.
Seriously, I mean, that's what I'm saying. You know, this whole country, don't you wish that just what? I mean, you get one of those Bulworth fantasies where you get just once that a guy like a president would just, you know, have one of those like State of the Union things or what it like where he asked the network to give him like 20 minutes on a Thursday night and he addresses all of the people of the country. And he just says, "We're all a bunch of tight asses. We all need to relax just a little bit. Let's all have some booze, you know, and just, you know, just tell everybody just to exhale just for a little bit."
Yeah.
Here's Don Taylor.
A shop in Alabama on Tuesday launched a Valentine's Day offer it hopes will trigger a large response in a limp economy. Customers can swap their guns for sex toys.
Oh, see, I thought it was going to be some sort of they were doing like a Viagra thing.
Okay. Sherry Williams, owner of the Pleasures Sex Toy Shop, said, "In today's economy, this is a way of helping people who may feel they can't afford something for Valentine's Day. The assorted erotica during the next week can be obtained in exchange for cast-off firearms."
It seems like you've got a gun. Really being able to afford an item is not really a problem.
Mm. Well, I'm sure that let's be fair. Most owners of firearms do not use them for criminal purposes.
Right, but if you're not going to use them for criminal purposes, why would you possibly give it away in exchange for something that doesn't equal the value of the gun?
Well, I don't understand that at all anyway.
You know how expensive sex toys are?
Well, okay, that's a fair point. That fleshlight doesn't come cheap.
No, it does not. And something that I've learned is, not personally, but through the folly of my friends, things you should never give a loved one at Valentine's Day for the potential repercussions, firearms and cutlery. Things that can come back on you and do bodily harm at some point in time. You don't want to give your loved one, like maybe a pair of foam nunchucks. Those are fine. Ninja stars, not so much.
You know what? Your last moment on Earth to be in regretful irony.
As soon as Pleasures opened its doors on Tuesday, a customer came in and exchanged an Ivor Johnson revolver for a $40 gift certificate that he spent in the shop, which stocks everything from steamy videos to naughty negligees.
Yeah, but either way, any retail business asking people to bring firearms into the store.
It seems ill-advised.
Yeah, it's like the opening to Bowling for Columbine, yeah. Where you're just like, yeah, we're in a bank, yeah. Bring us a gun.
I don't think they've gotten the advice of counsel prior
to this.
Well,
the woman who owns the shop, however, though, her husband is a licensed gun dealer and gunsmith.
Oh, so he might be able to dispose of it properly
he
or secure it or
something. He could probably resell it at quite a markup. If you're getting a $40 gift certificate
one of those
or a revolver.
If you just didn't know the sale was going on, though, and you just saw an endless line of guys going down the street, you know, with like bandoleros or something on, you might assume that, you know.
The revolution is here!
Helter Skelter's going down, brothers!
So she also says she's in it to get guns off the street, to take them out of the hands of people who would potentially do harm with them, and put them in the hands of collectors. Again, her husband is a licensed gun dealer.
With ties to Castro.
I guess she's just assuming the only people that basically there are a whole lot of criminals that might otherwise be shooting people with guns that are going to go, ooh, I could exchange this for a dildo? Sign me up.
Well, you know, I have nothing. I said, well, you know, ellipsis.
You're treading on very dangerous ground here.
As though I was going to go somewhere with that, and then I realized I had no actual end to that sentence.
This might be like an elaborate zombie apocalypse contingency plan. You know, like start a porn store, okay, and then convince people to exchange their guns for you know, overpriced novelty toys.
This is how Obama gets your guns, is he offers you dildos for them. That's the thing. That's how the man gets your firearms, Don.
Screws you right out of your guns.
Make love, not war.
Yes. Sure. It's the Rick Emerson radio program. Let's see. It seemed like I had something, like an interesting email I was going to read, but now it seems to be gone. Here is Don Taylor at the news desk.
An armed hostage situation at a bank in North Carolina has ended after police shot and killed the suspect who was holding one of the hostages at gunpoint.
Fantastic.
Obviously, if he had just traded his gun for like some kind of flavored love gel... Cary Police Chief.
I've seen some of those sex toys, though. You could really menace somebody with a few of those.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Those giant fists, those just terrify people.
We have something that I've affectionately referred to as the penis sword. And it is exactly what you are imagining.
Affectionately referred to as.
Well, you know, I mean, you can
penis sword.
You don't want to brandish it in hate, you know?
It's a good old penis sword.
It is. It's veiny and it's almost serrated in that capacity. But I'd say it's a good maybe foot and a half long.
Did Kevin Spacey make you put this on at gunpoint, or
he made me? No, it's like a basically it's like a dildo on one end, and then it comes down to like a nice like handle hilt on the other, and it's like, you know, there's that, and then we also have something that is for backdoor play, we'll say. But the handle is...
You don't want that to be serrated.
No. It's very much very smooth, but the handle is brass knuckles fashioned. So I've like gone through the store a couple of times with the sword in one hand and the brass knuckles in the other, like some kind of like adult superhero.
Ready to do battle.
Yes.
And so that when you say the handle is brass knuckles, is this so that one's grip doesn't slip during the act of whatever?
It's
ergonomic.
Yeah.
You don't want to get carpal tunnel.
No.
I guess that's if maintaining a steady rhythm of some kind is important, and if you have some sort of if perhaps there's like some sort of a lubrication agent that might make it difficult to hold on to a conventional.
Very true. Yeah, these are all
non-business end. Yes,
these are all dangers that one possibly runs into. It's from the fine people at Joanna Angel. So if you're interested, by all means, Google image search that.
Let me ask you this. We've mentioned this before. I'm doing that right now. The deal with the porn stars and with starlets, typically the porn actresses, where they will sell reproductions of various areas of their own body.
Yes.
What porn actress is the most popular in terms of sales? What porn actress sells moves the most units of like some reproduction of a part of her?
Well, it's hard to really pun intended. It's hard to say. There are the fleshlights are obviously very, very popular, and we do have our signature line now of various pieces of anatomy. However, those don't seem to have any kind of real consistency. We have also what's called affectionately slabs.
Which are basically lower portions.
But
people don't come in going like, you know, Jenna Hayes, you know, anything you got with Jenna Hayes on it.
Strangely enough, not very often.
So men in terms of sex toys and their and replicas are in fact the way they are in real life. Just sort of whatever's available.
Exactly.
Whatever you got at closing time.
Yeah, and I think maybe the fact that it is like the toys that do sell a little bit better are kind of faceless and nameless. I think maybe there is less of a shame element because I think maybe if there's an identity that can go along with that, then there's a sense of judgment. Like, you know, you can't ever have me, so here have something based on just like a small part of me. You know, this is as close as you're ever going to get.
Well, and also I think I like to think that men are becoming a little more, you know, utilitarian and practical about these things. Because, like, let's be honest. I mean, if women go to buy, women go to buy some sort of marital aid or a sex toy, which is fine. Rick Emerson's all for everybody doing whatever makes them happy.
Yeah.
But it's like women don't go buy a replica of a whole guy. Women are very practical. Women say, look, I only need, like, you know, this one area right here, and I'm good. The rest of him just sits and farts and watches TV. What do I need that for? So guys, I think, guys are supposed to be, you know, like, the logical gender and who really think to do. But guys are, like, for the longest time, been buying the, you know, it's like buying the whole cow when you only need the
udders.
Not udder. Well, maybe, I guess, depending. That's the Christy Canyon model. So I guess the fleshlight makes sense because that's what women have been doing for years. It's just buying the part you need. Well, you don't need the right. You're paying 100%. You only need 15%.
Right. Well, yeah, there is that woman that went around in like the 60s and 70s taking plaster molds.
Cynthia Plaster Caster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We actually have a home kit now that you can do that with. You can either make a standard plaster mold, or you can make one out of soap, or you can make one out of wax and have like a candle effect.
Here's how
I
know
that. And they are actually manufactured here locally in Portland.
And here's how I know that, because Sarah Dillon dated a guy. She told the story in the air. Sarah Dillon dated a guy who presented her with that like on their third date. He's like, and here's the thing we can use to make a plaster mold of my penis. And then there was like this long silence.
What?
And then
what?
She said effectively like, well, why do you have this, Bob? Why did you go buy – I mean, do I strike you as the kind of girl that would be really into this as like an evening's activity? I mean, I'm just curious. Why do you own this? And then he revealed, I think, ill-advisedly. He said, well, I bought it to use with my last girlfriend, but we never got around to it. So I thought maybe you would be interested in – and like by that point, I think the rest of the conversation was drowned out by the sound of her packing her things and leaving and getting in the car and driving away. So it just
seems
awkward.
If he really wanted
awkward.
This thing to be done so badly, did he really need a second – do you need a second person to help you with it or
– Jim?
Well, ideally, yes, because you're going to need to maintain a certain level of interest, we'll say, while the
one has to remain,
at alert. Oh. Yes, and so therefore, it's easier to do with somebody kind of like doing that sort of function of it because it is very cumbersome. It isn't something that you do every day unless you have like a very oversized rye bread that you're very
well,
intimate with.
And in fact, Cynthia Plastercaster herself was known to be skilled at certain forms of pleasure giving, which is then apparently how the rock stars in question would remain at alert during the process. Because that was an earlier time too, where the plaster took some time to dry or whatever. So
yeah.
Okay, even by our standards, it's gotten very awkward very quickly. and so forth. Well, let's just take a moment to exhale. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. Still to come, we have clue number 5 in the E.H. Vending Name That Snack Contest. What are we – are you showing on one of
the – Joanna Angel Brass Knuckle.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That looks like one of those fish that eats other fish.
It's
in the
very
tank.
Stylish, actually.
It is.
Sex toys have come a long way.
Yeah.
That's
I've got stuff that'll turn you white.
Okay.
That's not going very far with him. Or me, for that matter.
It's only half a step. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for another exciting installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. Here is your host, Mr. Big Jim Willig.
Thank you very much, Rick Emerson. Well, we all strive for greatness, but not everyone reaches that finish line. Right, other guy from Wham? Those lucky few who achieve greatness may only have it for a very short period of time. Right, Joe Bros? For all who defy the odds and manage to reach the mountaintop, there arises the desire to stay there indefinitely as a permanent fixture. But time, like Amy Fisher, is a fickle mistress and awards this brand of immortality to only a very select of these few. Consider for a moment Mel Brooks. In stature, Mel doesn't even register at 5.5 feet, but without question, a towering monolith of talent crammed into an unassuming package. A man who has managed to not only establish a reputation as a benchmark in comedic cinema, but to have done so in such a way as to no longer be within the reach of comparison. In other words, with Brooks, the bar has been set so high that we're not talking about pole vaulting anymore. We're debating the possibility of teleportation, transporting to a time before standards and practices, to an age when the PC police were still in Boy Scouts, back when the world still had an effing sense of humor. What Melvin Kaminsky was able to pull off is not only masterful, but the thing of legends. No, except for Spaceball, the animated series. That was a turd wrapped in fail, dipped in why? So with that, I go from suck to blow and turn the Schwartz on the other two Meshuggah Goyams in the studio with me at this time, Mr. Rick Emerson and Don Taylor. Your thoughts on the 2,000-year-old man, a.k.a. Mel Brooks.
Don Taylor?
Well, it's interesting. I actually was just talking about Mel Brooks a couple weeks ago on Ham-Fisted Radio with Bobby Roberts. And we were talking about Mel Brooks' film career that it's almost like, I mean, I guess it's a probably a 2/3 to 1/3 ratio. It feels more half to half as to what was really awesomely good that he made as far as a director of films. And what just didn't really work very well at all. And granted, his career goes way back beyond that. He was involved with, you know, your show of shows, and he did the Thousand-Year-Old Man with Carl Reiner. Yeah. And, I mean, he had a lot of stuff going on over the years. But really, we contemporaries, you know him mostly as a director of comedies. And, you know, starting with The Producers in 68, going through The 12 Chairs, which was really very good. And then he hit this amazing stride where he made, like, the two movies back-to-back with Gene Wilder, Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein, yeah, which personally I think are just impossible to beat. I mean, they are almost perfect movies.
Which is a thing of incredible accomplishment. And I love, because there's never going to be a Blazing Saddles 2. There's never going to be, you know, the son of Young Frankenstein. There's never going to be
a remake of Young Frankenstein with Adam Sandler, yeah, or
Seth Rogen.
Efron.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so, but as far as Mel's concerned, these movies, you know, they hit so hard and buried so far into the bedrock that, and did it in such a way that he got away with, I don't know who he knew or what blackmail material he had on who, but just the things that he got away with in those two films, it's just incredible. And I love the fact, like I said, that they can never be tainted by sequels or, you know, re-commercialization.
And I know I was very disappointed by High Anxiety, because it has always struck me that that Hitchcock is really ripe for satire. And somebody like Mel Brooks, who particularly looked at what he did with Young Frankenstein, obviously someone with a wonderful eye for satire and for all the minutiae and the detail for satire. And I felt that, you know, High Anxiety really fell flat in a lot of ways. But still, it's, yeah, unlike anything that anybody else was doing. And then History of the World Part 1, which is extremely hit and miss. And then Spaceballs, which...
Let's, yeah, not forget Silent Movie. In,
well,
there,
yeah,
too.
And Silent Movie was in there, and I still don't know how I feel about Silent Movie. There's a lot in Silent Movie that is hilarious.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then there was just suddenly, you know, then he hit that wall with Spaceballs, and I think it was just a matter of him trying to satirize something that he didn't particularly have a personal love for, and it just crashed and burned. I don't know. How do you feel about Spaceballs?
Well, it's hard because you got to separate Spaceballs from as with so many things of that era, you got to separate it from the what did Stephen King call it? A lens made foggy with the greasy film of nostalgia.
Plus, it also came out a full 10 years after the first Star Wars film was released.
So, separating it from the fact that, you know, that I saw it when I was whatever 12 or 13 or something. You look back now at Spaceballs, and again, it is. To be kind, it is hit and miss. There are things in Spaceballs that I quite like. There are moments that I like a lot. Just because no one had ever really done them as pointedly as he had. I actually quite like the sequence where he's talking about merchandising. Not because it's especially witty or well written, but because I just don't think I'd ever seen anybody flat out say that stuff before on the big screen. I don't think I'd. I mean, it was really a blunt tool the way that he did it. But I like the fact that somebody in a big screen movie just said, and we'll put the picture's name on all of this crap, you know? And it was, I mean, just for Stones, I sort of like the fact that he was doing that. And there's also just some great wordplay there. He's a guy that knows when to build the language and then when to bring it back. Like the good will always triumph evil will always triumph because good is dumb.
Yeah.
And, you know, and of course, I'm a sucker for Yiddish. So there's that. But you're right. The Spaceballs was the dividing line in that. Even if one is to give Spaceballs the benefit of the creative doubt and say that it's a thumbs up film, it was certainly the last thumbs up film he did. It's not like anybody's looking at Robin Hood Men in Tights, really, unless you're Sarah, and saying that it's a great film.
I like Robin Hood Men in Tights, though. I really do. And I would say that if I had to sit, sit through either that or Spaceballs, I would pick Robin Hood Men in Tights every time.
Because you would sexually assault Carrie Elwes, and you always have, and you always will.
Well, actually, I'm perverse enough that I always had like a huge crush on Richard Lewis. And so, you know, Richard Lewis is
so
in it.
Really is perverse.
Isn't it?
The Tracy Ullman character?
A friend of mine always laughs at the fact we were at a restaurant in L.A. once, and Richard Lewis was coming out of the restaurant as we were going in, and he was, of course, with this gorgeous blonde on his arm. And my friend, because we were all just hammered drunk, my friend goes, "Oh, my God, that's Richard Lewis." And I saw his shoulders just kind of hunch, like, "Oh, God, someone saw me." And my immediate response is I just looked at her and said, "Oh, great, now he'll never F me."
Awesome. My thing about it being a dividing line, Spaceballs, is I feel the same way about Mel Brooks' career in general. If you look back at, you know, like Blazing Saddles, for example, which Blazing Saddles, I have such complicated feelings about that movie because on the one hand, you can't take away from the fact that it made a huge, huge impact, and it's a cultural landmark. And there's a lot about that movie that is brilliantly done. In my opinion, most of the things that people latch onto in that movie as being especially interesting or funny are not the things about the movie that I latch onto. You know, like some of the constant farting in the campfire sequence or whatever, which I guess was really sort of interesting or groundbreaking when it came out, or funny. I think that's funny only contextually. It's only funny in the time.
That is the one. I don't like bodily function humor, and that is the one segment of that movie that I could happily just excise wholesale.
But again, it's so complicated because you got to view it through the prism of the era. And I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. Here's the thing. The closest analog to Mel Brooks. And I wonder if we would all say the same thing, because in my opinion, just speaking for myself, Mel Brooks is most similar to one other creative outlet. Anyone?
Creative outlet?
There's one other thing. There's one other element. There's one other thing in pop culture to which he is most similar. And it would be South Park.
Okay.
South Park, to me, there's a straight line. There is a direct line from the comedy of Mel Brooks to the comedy of South Park, in that South Park is equal parts social commentary, boundary-breaking, taboo-smashing use of the language. It's got a lot of lowbrow, dumb, language-based humor to it. And then it's got flat-out, just ridiculous, gross-out humor whose only purpose is for you to say, "I cannot believe I am watching Stan's father poop and barf simultaneously for 5 minutes on the screen."
Yeah.
"I cannot believe that Gary is vomiting, just a lake of bile out in the alley, and also he's a marionette." And we're like, the vomiting sequence in Team America just goes on and on, and you're like, "I cannot believe that this is happening." That to me is like the campfire sequence. So the campfire sequence is not funny to me, but maybe that's just because A, I'm with you in that I don't really find flatulence all that funny. But also, you know, maybe the thing of, you know, maybe the South Park, some of the scatological humor in South Park isn't going to be funny in 10 years because it'll be everywhere and because it will no longer be all that interesting. The funniest stuff to me about Blazing Saddles in particular is the way that he melds two worlds. One is the classic Borscht Belt Catskills style comedy, where it's the real corny, you know, like he's sort of like a Henny Youngman in the way he recycles these great classic gags from the early 30s and 40s. Like when what's his name says, "We'd like to extend," and he has the wreath, and he goes, "We'd like to extend a laurel and hearty handshake." And you see, and you go, that's so dumb. It's so bad. But it's great because that is a classic comedy of an earlier era that he melds to this weird surrealist thing where Clea Von Little is going through the desert and Count Basie is there with his orchestra for no reason. And then at the end, they're crashing into the Hollywood commissary where some Hollywood stars come to eat. And suddenly there's, you know, and then you've got Dom DeLuise, you know, directing this musical. And then suddenly there's a cowboy doing synchronized swimming with some guy in a tuxedo. And there's
a commissary.
Yeah. And then you're back in the town of Rock Ridge, you know, where you've got Gene Wilder, who is suddenly back in character, yet with popcorn that he got from Grauman's Chinese Theater. And then there's a limousine at the end. And that's, it blows my mind now, and I can't imagine what it was like to have seen it then. So the thing about Spaceballs being the dividing line between the two worlds, Mel Brooks' whole career is, to me, he is a bridge between the old-school 50s-style Borscht Belt comedy and the boundary-breaking comedy of the 70s and beyond that gave us things like SNL and Second City and South Park. He really was the first guy to take his comedy in a totally new way and to take it to a different level while holding on to classic elements of the past and to make it work.
And the other thing to keep in mind about Blazing Saddles in particular that I think people coming to it later don't really understand is that that movie was released in 1974, which essentially was really just the tail end of the 60s.
Yeah.
If you figure the 60s itself lasted well into like 1972, 73, this movie came out in 1974 and it was dealing with race issues.
Right.
It was dealing with race issues in a hilarious way, but also in a just a great big slap you across the face manner.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really very controversial at the time that the movie came out.
And he also, you know, he gets credit for fighting. You know, he tried to cast Richard Pryor in the Clea Von Little role, and they wouldn't let him cast Richard Pryor because Pryor was known to have a bit of a drug problem even at that point. Well, even, you know, relatively, you know, early in his career, they viewed him as way too stable and unstable, and they thought he was going to be an insurance risk. What they said is he'll never be able to finish the picture, and we will have spent half the production budget, and we'll have to go back and reshoot it. They said, you got to get a guy who'll make it all the way through the picture. So Brooks split the difference. He hired Clea Von Little, but Richard Pryor is one of the writers. So if you watch the opening credits where Frankie Lane is singing that, you know, he rode a blazing saddle, and it says, you know, right as you get to that part when he's seeing Count Basie, it says written by, and you'll see Mel Brooks and Richard Pryor. And I mean, the idea that he really went to the mattress as far as he possibly could to get Richard Pryor, who had already developed a terrible reputation in Hollywood, to be on that movie because Brooks was smart enough to know what he didn't know and to know where he needed some assistance. And I'm totally with you on, I admire anybody who is able to use their art to just sort of punch people in the face a little bit and say, hey, look at this, or think about things in a different way, or ask, or provoke people to wonder why they view certain ideologies or certain words or phrases in a certain context. It's the same thing with the producers, the original producers movie. It's a victim of its own success, not unlike Playboy magazine or their band Nirvana, in that they changed the landscape so much that they themselves don't seem all that groundbreaking anymore. Everything, you know, changed after Playboy magazine, so it seemed outdated and corny. Everything changed after Nirvana, so Nirvana doesn't sound all that interesting now. You go back and watch the producers, the original now, and younger generations, and even myself to some degree, you kind of go, well, you know, I don't know. I don't quite see what the big deal with this is. But you have to put yourself in the
musical number about Hitler.
Right, but that's because we're living in a post-Monty Python, post-SCTV, SNL era. Again, in the era of South Park, I don't know that a four-minute song about Hitler once late in the film is all that shocking. But then 20 years after World War II is not that long. And here's a Jewish guy making a film in which Hitler is a flaming gay man, and they are singing, you know, Springtime for Hitler in Germany, and, you know, Don't Be Stupid, Be a Smarty, Come and Join the Nazi Party, and all that stuff.
Goose-stepping chorus boys.
And I mean, and I saw, and it gives me actually chills to think about this, but I saw an interview with Mel Brooks where they said they talked about the producers, and they said, you know, well, you've made the producers the original film, you've made the producers the Broadway musical, you know, then you're making the Broadway musical into its own film, the producers. They said, when is enough with that? And it was him being interviewed, and he was very serious. I mean, he's a funny guy, but again, it was like he was not in character. He was doing a serious interview as a filmmaker and a creator. And they said, when are you going to stop with that? And he said, never. He said, I will never stop kicking, spitting on, and tap dancing on the corpse of Adolf Hitler. He said, I will make Hitler jokes until the day I die. He said, I am a Jew who was born before World War II, who has a greatly diminished number of family members because we were born Jewish and because of Adolf Hitler. And he said, I will ridicule him and I will depict him as a flamboyant, tap dancing, gay idiot until they put me in a box. And I was like,
go, baby.
Yeah. I mean, what are you going to say to that guy? You know, it's like there's nothing you can say in response to that.
Well, in the vein of what you were saying about how once you change the landscape, what you've done to do so kind of loses its kind of punch in a sense. Though Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein are often cited as the most popular films, is actually most commercial successes were Spaceballs and Robin Hood Men in Tights. Right. So, like, those two, which came out in the same year, which is ridiculous. Like, one by itself, you know, in that year would have been enough to cement you as an incredible talent. But both of them back to back, it's like, well, there is no question. But what I also like is the fact that he kept a very core group of players. Like, there's always the Harvey Kormans. Right. There's always, you know, the Gene Wilder, and whenever he could include Richard Pryor in that as well. Very similar to, like, the Seth Rogen kind of, like, you know, knocked up 40-year-old virgin. Like, they keep that core group of guys through all the different films because they know that it's a guaranteed, you know, punch.
Right.
In that sense, without taking a risk, by putting somebody else in there. And plus, by keeping them in these movies together, they build a tighter relationship with one another. So when they do ridicule each other, it's stronger than the words they're saying, I think.
I also, you know, the other thing about Mel Brooks is that one of the places he doesn't get, I think, although he has in recent years, I suppose because of the producers, he doesn't get enough credit for being a songwriter. Because if you look at most of Mel Brooks' films that have music, that usually is written by or co-written by him. The Ballad of Rock Ridge from Blazing Saddles. I Feel Tired from Blazing Saddles.
The songs and the producers.
The songs and the producers, of course. The song High Anxiety. And I'm with you on High Anxiety in that I view it as a failed experiment. It was not even an experiment. I give him points for trying to satirize Hitchcock because that seems impossible anyway. But he paid a lot of attention to it, and it doesn't ring false. It just rings not successful. But not unlike with Young Frankenstein, where he actually went so far as to get the original equipment and props from Universal Studios that they used for those, for the original Frankenstein films. That's all the original prop and production design that you see in Young Frankenstein. You see Young Frankenstein, you see Blazing Saddles, and you see High Anxiety, and clearly that is a guy who understands and loves those films, and that's the reason he was able to parody them, you know, successfully in some cases, less successfully in others. And you're right with Spaceballs, that he's obviously not a sci-fi fan, which is why that doesn't ring very, very true these days.
With the actual Broadway production of The Producers, I remember reading an interview with him. He was really looking hard for the right songwriter to write the songs for the Broadway musical and having a really hard time coming up with anybody. And Anne Bancroft said to him, well, why don't you write the songs?
Right.
And he said, well, I'm not a songwriter. And she just looked and said, yes, you are. And like basically counted down from all the songs he's written for all his different movies. And he basically went, I guess you're right. I am a songwriter. And so then he wrote the songs for the musical.
You know, he really is. And that's, again, the sort of the South Park thing that, you know, you think of Trey Parker, and you don't go, Trey Parker, the songwriter. You think Trey Parker, the South Park guy, but who has created some of the best and most interesting and groundbreaking songs in the melding of comedy to traditional song arrangement of the last 20 years. Yeah, and Mel Brooks, I think, is without him, you don't have a Trey Parker, probably.
And with Bigger, Longer, and Uncut, I mean, that movie is just—it's filled with incredible arrangements. The part right before the
La Resistance medley.
Yeah, where they all come together, and you're just like—I remember being like almost moved by that. I'm just like, this is a movie where, you know, you're actually watching a lot of fecal humor and everything else. But at the same time, you're like, you cannot deny that medley is not just knock you on your ass.
And that's
impressive.
Trey Parker clearly, and he has collaborators. Mark Shaman is the guy who works with him in a lot of that stuff. But they obviously love they love musicals, and they love that big, huge, loud, bombastic, flamboyant style of song that you really only get in an Oklahoma or in a Les Mis.
Interesting side note, Trey Parker is in the Disney film Newsies. He's only visible in, like, I think one of the massive scenes where you get all the Newsies kind of together, but there is a very young Trey Parker standing in the background singing and dancing.
He's got the background
in musical theater.
I think if you were to take South Park the Musical and somehow beam it back into the 70s, and you were to tell people, like, this is, you know, the next great genre for Mel Brooks to destroy is animation, I mean, I don't think it would seem out of place. I mean, I think it is conceivable in some alternate universe that that's a Mel Brooks thing. And again, that is all about his influence as a filmmaker. At this point, to say that, you know, to look at the Mel Brooks film canon to say that it's mostly misses, or that there's a lot of not even just bad stuff, but just sort of toothless comedy. Because, you know, Robin Hood Men in Tights or Spaceballs or, you know, like the Dracula film he did with Leslie Nielsen. The thing about those movies is, it's not even that they're bad. It's that it's like Robin Hood Men in Tights or Spaceballs, for example. What they are Blazing Saddles or Young Frankenstein with the social commentary or the envelope pushing humor taken out, because that's the balance that made him work. The mixture of social taboo and edginess and corny comedy, because his movies are always corny.
Yeah.
But it was the mix that made them work. And if you subtract half of that, you're just left with the corniness, which is why those movies don't have it, because there's not enough depth or substance to them.
Once you push the envelope as hard as he has, you can't undo that crease in the paper. There's just no way. So after that, there's always going to be kind of a flappiness. The substance, the wall of which you've pushed, is no longer a solid wall anymore. It's kind of like a flan-like consistency. One last thing about Brooks that I would like to say is that he is one of the few people to win an Oscar, an Emmy, a Grammy, and a Tony. So, I mean, regardless of what some of his later films kind of garnished in the ways of, like, you know, praise as you know, the greats have, he does have that, like, that hat trick plus one kind of mentality.
Well, that was actually when I said that his later films notwithstanding. The thing about it is, it doesn't matter. He can make 100 bad films, but he doesn't have to prove anything to me or anybody else.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, most people, filmmakers go their whole lives. They don't make one movie that impacts the way that, you know, a Young Frankenstein did, or Blazing Saddles, or even, like, God, he wrote for Get Smart.
Yeah.
I mean, you watch Get Smart, and, like, half the things on that show came out directly out of the brain of Mel Brooks. You know, for one guy to do all of that stuff, he doesn't have to prove anything to anybody. And you also got to give him credit for being, like, 1,000 years old, no pun intended, for being the 2,000, you know, to being 2,000 years old and having this whole second and third act with Broadway productions of The Producers and Young Frankenstein.
Well, he's currently, what, 85 years
old? Yeah.
Yeah.
And who does that? You know?
The husband of, I can't remember what the actress's name is, but she basically played the female lead in the Young Frankenstein musical that Mel produced. We interviewed her husband because he was working on some side project on Comedy Central, and he was at some of the cast parties for that when it first debuted on Broadway. And we're like, was Mel there? And he's just like, oh, absolutely, Mel was there. And not only was Mel at the party, Mel was drunk. Mel was dancing on a table at one point in time. I mean, still every much full of life, full of the fact that, you know, he's like a dynamo when it comes to that in-your-face beautiful comedy that, regardless of what sorrow his people have been through, he's just going to keep, like you said, punching it in the face until his fists can no longer carry the weight.
And just as sort of a weird personal anecdote about the kind of man he is, when I was in high school, I had a couple of friends and I, and we were huge, huge fans of Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein. And my friend Betsy wrote Mel Brooks a letter telling him, you know, I'm in high school and these are like my favorite
movies. My friend wants to F you.
And he wrote her back a letter, which I believe was dictated. It was typed, you know, and all that sort of thing. But he signed it. But it was like he wrote her back a lengthy letter, just responding. And it was obviously a personal letter. It responded to things she had actually said.
Wow.
And at the very end of it, he said something like, unless you think that I'm being impersonal by typing you, by sending you this typewritten missive, actually, I have handwritten this letter. I just have very, very, very precise handwriting.
Awesome.
And she wrote him back and said, thank you for the letter. I was surprised. And he ended up actually corresponding with her three or four times. He actually wrote her back a couple of times.
I'm a loser.
Yeah. I'm on that. I am so on that. Yeah.
Okay. And by the way, we'll just end it all by saying, and he gave us Max Brooks. So,
well, that too.
Seriously, that's one of those like Stephen King's kid goes on to write like one of the most acclaimed like horror novels of 2003 or whatever when it came out, and he wrote it under a different name and nobody knew he was Stephen King's kid. That's where you just give up.
Yeah.
You just go like, I'm not gonna win this race. So, there you go, Mr. Big Jim Willig, and this week's installment of Humor Me. Comedy 101 brought to you by Squires Electric. Find out more by going to squireselectric.com. That is 503-252-1609. Ask them if they can bring out one of those zzz things from the from the Frankenstein lab, the Jacob's ladder thing, where it's like
the Tesla coils and such.
Yes. Now, what is the Tesla coil? Is that the thing that's in the ball?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's like a resurgence of those like in the late 80s, or is that just an ongoing resurgence for teenagers because you buy it at a head shop?
No, you could get them. They sold them at like the Sharper Image and stuff. And then I think you could get
little cheaper ones
at like Spencer's Gifts and things like that.
And so when you put on Dark Side of the Moon, it wobbles back and forth in time to the music or something? I always wondered if that was like a thing that, you know, like one out of four of those would be manufactured incorrectly and it would kill you, because it seemed like it was very dangerous.
They do seem dangerous.
It doesn't seem like the sort of thing you should be selling stone teenagers.
No.
What do I know? In any event, Squires Electric can answer that or any other questions you might have about the electrical system in your home or business. Contact them at 503-252-1609. 503-252-1609. Electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, wiring for your office intercom system. Maybe wiring to your release the hounds button or to a trap door that exists in front of your desk that goes onto a piranha-filled tank. Whatever it is you might have, or maybe something you're getting installed. Maybe you have secret passageways or paneling being put into your home. Maybe there's a bookcase that when adjusted slightly leads to a layer of catacombs below your home. Whatever, they can help you with a lot of this. That's probably what Seamus was wanting to contact them about. I mean, really, who's to say? In any event, 503-252-1609 is how you contact Squires Electric. They are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical installers, contractors, and supervisors. Good people, longtime listeners of the Rick Emerson Show, extended members of the family. Please do tell them you heard about it here. Squires Electric at squireselectric.com or 503-252-1609. All right, so we're like 21 after here, so a couple things.
Yogurt?
Why do you got to do that? Why do you got to take it back to yogurt all the time? There's something really wrong with you. Let's see. I had just a little bit of business that I wanted to read here. Let's see. Our friends at I do want to say this. Our friends at Guardian Games, where many of you, because I don't know, Patrick just goes to some guy's house on Thursdays, right?
Yeah, but I mean, he does go to Guardian Games on a regular. I mean, he hasn't really played games there, but he does go there to shop.
So Guardian Games, I actually haven't been there in a while, so I was not aware of this. But did you know they're opening a whole brand new section in that store? They actually got a liquor license. And so they're going to be so they actually have now a whole section. So when you walk in, there's that door in the far end back by the video games. There actually is now a whole new section of the store having its grand opening tomorrow. That is Saturday the 12th. Tomorrow, Saturday the 12th, from 1 p.m. to close, 21 and over, for that section of it. And they're going to have some, say, like 20% off board games and whatnot. But there's also they're going to be serving adult beverages. So I believe the I believe that. I don't think it's just the event. I believe that whole section of the store is called Critical Sip. That is the that's what they're going to be calling.
So I could go with Patrick, and he could like hang out with his friends out in the front part, and he could be his like barbarian orc and hang out with his buddy.
Now with Mead.
He's like the warlord.
Yes.
On the war dog fighting the vampire frogs or whatever. And I could just go sit in the back and get hammered.
You know nothing of our people.
Not that we advocate that sort of a thing. Having fought long and hard to get their liquor license, we, of course, realize that everyone will be drinking responsibly in an adult fashion.
Right.
But, I mean, grog is there to be consumed, is it not?
Actually, the pirates are going to be there probably.
Well,
right?
That's true.
Yeah,
so,
there will be nothing responsible with the pirates.
Do they have one of those neon signs in the window that just says Romulan Ale?
They
like
should.
Now served here.
Well, because there's certain – I think the OLCC has a lot of like regulations about what advertising you can and cannot put in windows, too, in addition to all of their other fun laws. So there totally should be like a Quark's Bar sort of a line of line of flicker. Neon things
we now
you
accept
can just
Latinum.
Yeah. So that is happening tomorrow, the 12th, at Guardian Games, 1 to close, 21 and over for that part of it. And Critical Sip is the name of that new section of the store. So we encourage you to go by and say hey to those guys. And then, by the way, we'll talk more about this next month. Coming up March 26th there, they've got a thing happening called Geeklesque. And I said, well, what is Geeklesque? And they said, okay, well, imagine Wonder Woman stripping. And here's the thing is I really didn't have to imagine it all that hard because it was just sort of – it's like one of those ready –
Loading, please wait. All right.
Is this gonna be one
that's in my cache already.
This is going to be one of those things where a girl is like dancing around in a white bikini and a stormtrooper mask.
Do not belittle this genius idea, Don Taylor.
You'll have to go to find out, Don.
Bring singles.
No, it was, she just said, well, imagine Wonder Woman stripping. And then I think I just actually lapsed into silence and I was sort of staring into the middle distance for a while. And then it became really awkward. And so we just moved back to the whole critical sip thing. That is Guardian Games. So there you go. So there's that. Okay, well, we should do the EH Vending final clue.
Yes.
We'll roll that out here in a second. Are there any critical news stories that we have not gotten to? Anything of stunning importance that has not been to – well, once again, not get to Democracy in the March.
No, I got nothing.
All right, so I will say Outlook Portland coming up this Sunday, 6:30 on the CW, which is Cable Channel 3, or at OutlookPortland.com. Jim Willig, anything coming up in your world, comedy shows, festivals, spectaculars, events?
I've got one coming up in about a week, but it is kind of like a private show. It's at a marijuana dispensary. So
is it really?
It is.
That's an easy crowd.
Oh, kidding me? It's like shooting, you know, stone ducks in a very small barrel.
Wow, okay.
Nice.
Wow, good
with
for
a
you.
Very large gun.
Well done. Don Taylor?
I will be hanging out at the pot dispensary just because that's what I do.
Okay.
And I'm excited to know Jim's going to be there,
Looking
too.
Looking for some vampire frogs. Let's do this.
All right, then. Well, on that note, it's time to reveal the final E.H. Vending Name That Snack clue for this week. That is the week of February 7th, 2011. So it is Friday the 11th. Here comes clue number 5. I will say this is brought to you by E.H. Vending. If you are not happy with your current vending provider, don't take matters into your own hand, kids. Call the equalizer. The equalizer in this case being E.H. Vending. You can contact either Joshua at 360-816-1853 or James at 503-897-8204. And so if you are the worker, the employee, you're stuck there in a day of office drudgery because you know the boss doesn't bring in nothing to consume, and then you sit there and you look longingly at the window thinking about a better life somewhere where there is a greater variety of Twizzlers, you need to long for that no longer. If your company contacts EH Vending, they have the vending machines taken care of. They also do, I mean, in addition to the regular snack and soda machines, they get your coffee service. If you're a deli, if you need those sort of glass front fridges at the back, they can get that taken care of, and they can do it at a price it's going to be probably whatever you're paying right now. So if you got your vending guy and you feel like he's giving you the runaround, as they say, it's become a clip job, then you want to contact EH Vending and they will find a way to make it worth your while. And maybe they can, maybe they can have the other guy handled. You know, you never know. It's, depending on, you just did however many machines you were going to get, there might be a little bonus that comes along with that. I mean, you didn't hear that from me, but Josh can be contacted at 360-816-1853 or 503-897-8204. If you are a small company who's been turned away from other vending services because they want you to have a certain number of outlets and you just don't meet, big enough to warrant their interest, EH Vending is the company you want to contact because they will find a way to make it work for almost anybody. And not unlike Squires Electric, they at EH Vending are longtime listeners of the show, listening for 13 years. So despite that obvious lapse in taste, they are people who know what they are doing in the world and realm of vending machines. So contact them at EHVending.com.
And really, get a damn vending machine. You need a vending machine.
Should be their slogan. Just get a friggin' vending machine before I bust your beak.
Yeah.
Knock, knock, knock. Who's there? Hired goons.
I realize... hired... Okay. By the way, Don, you have to kill a little time. You have to kill like 30 seconds because I realize that I don't have the clue in front of me right now.
Oh,
and
it's, okay.
You'll understand what I mean here in just a second. So
I'm operating on about 4.5 hours worth of sleep.
You
so
should
I'm
be
just
funnier.
Kind of like a, I know I should be. Well,
Jim, say
we've
something
heard that
funny.
Before. Don should be funnier.
Bring forth the chuckle monkey so that he may be funny. Now entertain us.
Bring
please.
Me the king's fool.
Simba, grab him.
You're not gonna. You're not gonna say anything funnier.
I got nothing. I got nothing funny to say.
Here is clue number 5 for this week's Name That's Not contest, courtesy of EH Vending.
I'm thinking of funny things now, but now it's too late.
Are you?
No. I was just going to say something like, I'm a porpoise. That made no sense, so because that makes me laugh.
Ladies and gentlemen, clue number 5. There you go. And with that, we now bring a curtain down on this, another exciting episode of the Rick Emerson Radio
Program. Oh, was that
program.
The clue?
That was the clue.
Oh, that was the clue.
You see why I had to, it took me a second?
Yeah.
It wasn't like all the other clues. It was different.
Oh.
Sam.
It's called range. Look into it.
Right, Don. I'm a man of many layers and textures. And so forth.
Are any of them yogurt?
Bloomin' Onion of Win.
We're ending this now. After a brief interlude, we'll have an encore of today's very fine Legion of News episode, followed by an encore of this radio program. And then that'll be playing and encoring all weekend long, 24-7 right here at RickEmersonShow.com. So if you're listening to this on podcast, don't forget it does stream live around the clock, day or night, wherever you might be at RickEmersonShow.com. We are, and I've totally talked past the close of the thing, we're live from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district here in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, it is Don Taylor, Advanced Technology Magic, provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, Executive Producer Bruce Agler, Chief of Staff Cheryl Kanakoa. We want to thank our guests, including Mr. Big Jim Willig.
You are welcome.
Joining us here today.
And Big Bunk!
So forth. It is Friday, February 11th, 2011, and that is the frequency, Kenneth. So, as always, thank you for listening. Be safe. See you all Monday. Bye now. Have a fantastic weekend.